Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Welcome back to All of It. There is a very special anniversary happening this week. Spike Lee's seminal film, Do the Right Thing, came out over the 4th of July weekend in 1989. Certainly no accident there on the release date, as the film is a sophisticated examination of power and race in America. The story takes place in Bed-Stuy on the hottest day of the year, with tensions and emotions over ownership, gentrification, and violence running high. When you hear this trailer, it really takes you back. The voices are so familiar. Rosie Perez, Spike, Danny Aiello, Ossie Davis. Here is a bit of the trailer from Do the Right Thing.
Ooh-wee. It's going to be a scorcher today.
Universal Pictures presents a new film from Spike Lee.
Good morning, Miss Mother Sister.
Now, Mookie, don't work too hard today. The man says it's going to be hot as the devil.
I've been here 25 years. LaSalle's famous pizzeria is here to stay.
Trust me.
Mookie, the last time I trusted you, we ended up with a son.
I know you can't stand it. You can't stand it.
Hey, Sal, I'm looking to bust for the wall here.
You want brothers on the wall?
Love.
Get your own place. You can do what you want to do.
What I tell you about that noise?
What I tell you about them pitch?
To celebrate the 30th anniversary of the film's release, Spike Lee is hosting a block party on the very same block featured in the film on Sunday, June 30th. Also starting today, IFC will be screening a new 4K digital restoration, as well as the archival 35mm print for 7 days as part of the whole 30th anniversary re-release of the film. Here to discuss the cultural legacy of Do the Right Thing is New York Times culture writer and critic at large, Wesley Morris. Wesley, welcome to All of It.
Hi.
Hey.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you think we should be celebrating when we think about Do the Right Thing?
Well, first of all, you were celebrating one of the greatest movies ever made in the history of American movie making. So there's that. You're also celebrating the fact that it was made by a black man, written by a black man, produced by one, starring some amazing black people, some amazing actors of all races, actually. I think you were, I mean, celebrating is a tough one, right? You were also recognizing in this celebration that this movie managed in ways that I, as a person, even as a person who's seen this movie more than a dozen times, still does not quite know how it was achieved, but it is a movie that manages to be both very much in its moment in 1989, but also timeless. And it isn't simply the fact that the racism the film depicts is with us still. It's more the refusal that Spike Lee makes to resolve anything in a way that we are conditioned as moviegoers and as cultural consumers to expect a work of art and culture to do, which is to tell us what the right thing actually is. And the truth is, the movie doesn't really doesn't have any answers.
Yeah, it's interesting. There was an interview with Spike in, I think, at the Hollywood Reporter today that said that the studio wanted there to be a big hug it out at the end. And he just said, absolutely not. That's not what this movie is about. So when we think about a movie like this, at the time, was there anything like it out there? What was it? What was it changing or shifting in the movie landscape?
You mean like what? Okay, so in 89, by the time you get to 1989, the summer of 89, there definitely weren't a lot of movies that were taking on the subject of race as a contemporary matter, right? Mm-hmm. There were lots of historical films. There was lots of movies that were about moments in time, or, you know, there were black movie stars, but there weren't works that really considered what it would mean to live in this country as a black person in a city that is changing, or in a neighborhood in a city that is changing, and changing for reasons that have so much to do with all the things that we don't like to talk about in this country involving race and class and, you know, all the infrastructural disadvantages that people who live in certain neighborhoods in this country face every day. And so that summer, you know, the other crazy thing about that summer is it isn't so okay. It was like no other movie that had come before it in many ways, but it also was the way Spike Lee delivers it to you. It also is very much in correlation, I would argue, with lots of theater and specifically I'm thinking about like Greek tragedy and the way, the sort of two-dimensional way the film operates just as a matter of presentation. Now, I'm sure Spike Lee would have a more sophisticated way of putting this across than what I'm about to say, but there is something very magical about the way that it sort of flattens out this neighborhood, not in terms of emotion or drama or politics, but just in terms of the way, what you'd call in the movie, the way the axis works, where one person stands on one side of the camera, and when there's a reverse shot, another person is there in pretty much the same geometric position in the frame, right? There are so many little cinematic tricks that he uses to violate the sort of norms of movie making in terms of the way a movie would normally proceed with tracking shots and cuts and that sort of thing and canted angles. But there's also something about the way the characters aren't really three-dimensional characters. They're all archetypes. And that, to me, comes out of a long theatrical tradition.
My guest is Wesley Morris. He's a New York Times critic at large. We're talking about the 30th anniversary of Do the Right Thing. So the movie, as you said, is one of the greatest movies. You said one of the best of all times. It was nominated for Best Screenplay, and Danny Aiello got an acting nom for Oscars. But it didn't get Best Picture. It wasn't nominated. That went to Driving Miss Daisy.
Yes.
So it's really... So you said on your podcast with Jenna Wortham called Still Processing, which is great, that you were talking about with Jenna this idea of America wanting this fantasy of racial healing is how you guys talked about it. And mm-hmm. That Do the Right Thing really rejected this narrative. When you think about Driving Miss Daisy winning versus Do the Right Thing, what comes to your mind? I just want to hear your thoughts on it.
Well, you know, I can remember at the time, I don't know where you were when this was happening. I think we're pretty much the same age. Mm-hmm. I feel like I can remember loving this movie and wanting everything good to happen to it. And I also was aware, I was old enough to have followed enough Academy Award ceremonies and to understand the history of the show and the politics of the way these things work to get that the odds were low that this movie was going to go any farther than it actually went. You know, Universal had other priorities. And I just felt like it was too radical for the Academy. The politics of this movie are too radical for the Academy. There was nothing for the overwhelmingly white Academy to really relate to in terms of characters, right? The brilliance of the movie is that everybody does the wrong thing. Or they do the right thing, depending on where you stand politically and socially. But there's nothing. Driving Miss Daisy gives you something that is very familiar, and it tells you a story that you want to believe about America and black people and white people. That no matter what, even if the racist lady that you work for decides that she, due to prolonged experience to your black self, is going to have a change of heart and want to be your friend, which she only admits she wants to do when she's having her first episode of dementia, just throwing that out there. That is a thing that we are much more comfortable with than the end of Do the Right Thing, where after the incident that happens in this on this block in this neighborhood in Brooklyn, Mookie, the Spike Lee character, basically isn't sorry. He just wants to get paid. And that is essentially your finale. That is a daring thing, and I don't think anybody who votes for Best Picture really like had any time to even contemplate something that made them feel, if not bad, definitely ambivalent about life in this country. First, he's driving Miss Daisy, which is dessert.
I want to play a clip from Do the Right Thing, and it's an issue 30 years later still dealing with gentrification in Brooklyn. Let's take a listen.
You almost knocked me down, man. The word is excuse me.
Excuse me. I'm sorry.
Not only did you knock me down, you stepped on my brand new white Air Jordans that I just bought. And that's all you can say is excuse me? Who told you to step on my sneakers? Who told you to walk on my side of the block? Who told you to be in my neighborhood?
I own this brownstone.
Who told you to buy a brownstone on my block, in my neighborhood, on my side of the street?
It's so prescient. Or is it that the issue is just pervasive and not going away?
It's both, right? I think, you know, here is also a thing. You know, Jenna Wortham on our show really found this scene in this movie really striking in that it manages without saying anything about home ownership in these neighborhoods or anything about, you don't really know who lives where in the neighborhood. You don't know who is a homeowner and who is a renter. You can make some assumptions that maybe mother, sister, who's played by Ruby Dee in the movie, probably owns her house. But when this white guy who is wearing these Jordans with his bike and his bike shorts, who's played by John Savage in the movie, announces, when these guys figure out that this guy's there, it tells you a story about what is probably happening in this neighborhood and by extension in neighborhoods all over the country. And the tension exists it's also funny in this moment because the tension comes out of this character bugging out's upset about the sneakers, but also, you know, he's the neighborhood rabble rouser, the neighborhood activist, but he doesn't really have any solutions, any practical solutions for any of these problems. There's nothing he can do about gentrification happening in his neighborhood. But his solution, of course, is to just have the people in the neighborhood acknowledge the existence of black people in general. And having Michael Jordan on your sneaker is not quite acknowledgement enough.
Two things that are really interesting about this movie, I think. One, Ruth Carter did the costuming, who of course just won for Black Panther. And it's really super subtle because John Savage, the white brownstone owner, is wearing a Celtics jersey.
Larry Bird.
So there's all this sort of like subtext about sports as well. And it's and identifiers through your clothes. The other thing I think is interesting, and please back me up, correct me if I'm wrong, people think the movie starts with Fight the Power, but I think it starts with Lift Every Voice and Sing. For like a
yeah,
few
that's the
bars,
first thing you
right?
hear. Yeah, and then Fight the Power starts, and then you get that great opening sequence with Rosie Perez dancing.
But that's such an interesting, the Black National Anthem, and then Fight the Power.
Mm-hmm.
Should this be our new anthem? Should this be the new Black National Anthem?
I think there's so many. I mean, it felt the other sort of bold choice about this movie, and again, sort of calling out to the theatrical nature of this movie, and Spike Lee's really thinking about everything a movie can do. He just uses this one song over and over and over again, and it becomes a theme. I mean, there are other songs in the movie. You played, in the trailer, Can't Stand the Heat is, you know, that I love that song. I think about that every single summer since I've seen that movie. even when I've not heard it in its entirety in a long time, but there isn't a summer that passes where I don't think about that. But Fight the Power, the juxtaposition of Lift Every Voice and Fight the Power, I mean, it completely establishes the sort of the political dynamic and the tension and the poles of the movie, right? On the one hand, you have this anthem of pride and self-reliance, and on the other, you have this anthem, this instant anthem of anger and retaliation and upset.
My guest is Wesley Morris. He's a New York Times critic at large. We're talking about the 30th anniversary of Do the Right Thing. By the way, Spike Lee's hosting a block party on the very same block featured in the film. It's going to be on Sunday, and the film is being re-released in theaters in New York. I do want to play another clip, and it's going into that idea of who has ownership of the neighborhood. It's when Ossie Davis's character goes into a Korean deli and is really, really upset that they don't have his beverage of choice. Let's take a listen.
Where's the Miller High Life? Where is the Miller High Life?
No more High Life. You look what we have in Dubai.
No more High Life? What kind of a joint is this? How come no more High Life? Look, doctor, this ain't Korea or China or wherever you come from. You get some Miller High Life in this joint.
I like that Spike Lee doesn't let anybody off the hook. To your point, nobody's doing the right thing.
No. I mean, everybody's a little bit racist. Everybody has some weird view about, you know, the way things ought to be happening in the neighborhood. And in the sort of macro scheme of things, everybody... The way the problems work, they're so much bigger than the people they affect. And so everybody is trying to figure out with their little tiny scrap of comfort and safety and selfhood can be. And it's always abutting somebody else's idea of that selfhood. And in the way that you have these Koreans who own this bodega. I found that scene really, the more times you watch the movie, the more questions you have about, you know, for instance, what Damer's life actually was like before you met him. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, the idea that he is, you know, on the one hand, you've had these kids in the neighborhood who make fun of him as being, you know, drunk and slovenly and out of sorts. But what are the conditions that like led this otherwise regal seeming man to be this person? I don't know. And then the Koreans, of course, the man, the husband and wife who own that bodega, by the end of the movie, they have to make this choice about how they're going to align themselves, both as a matter of racial identity and as a matter of capitalist identity, right? Are they with Sal, the pizzeria owner, or are they with the people in the neighborhood who shop in his store? Who, you know, I don't know what racist incidents may have happened in that store. There is a conversation at some point about the fact that the store is there. But I don't know. It's a really fascinating. I mean, there's so many little complexities in this movie and so many shadings of realities that don't seem to have a fixed time, which is why the movie is timeless, right? It doesn't explain any of the things that are happening in this neighborhood at all. There's no news clip of it. You know, there's no like, you know, it's 7 o'clock and blah, 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 blah. It's just all you get are weather updates and playlists. Those are the only sort of extra narrative outside into the world information that you get.
My guest has been Wesley Morris. We were talking about the 30th anniversary of Do the Right Thing. Wesley, thanks so much for being with us.
I am so glad that you chose to talk about this movie.
Yo, man, your Jordans are fucked up.
Damn, man, you might as well throw them shits out. Them shits is broke.
Man, they looked at it good before he messed up. He did this shit on purpose, man. He was even talking about your mama.
What part of that shit you make me so Yo, man, how much you pay for them?
$100
American dollars.
$108 with tax.
Nike is once again in the center of a heated political debate. This time, it's about sneakers that Nike has decided not to sell. The company says it's withdrawing its 4th of July Air Max 1 sneaker. The red and white shoes feature a colonial version of the American flag on the back of the heel, 13 stars for the original colonies. Former NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick reportedly was the one who asked Nike to reconsider the design, arguing that it celebrates the time when slavery was both legal and common. NPR's Alina Selyukh joins us now with more on this controversy. And Alina, what more have we learned about why Nike pulled this shoe?
So this week, the company was slated to release this shoe. As you were saying, it is designed for the 4th of July Independence Day, and it has this historic flag known as the Betsy Ross flag. And the design had been making rounds on sneakerhead sites and Instagram, where comments were starting to pop up sort of, why is Nike basically promoting an era of slavery? This is a flag that is most often found in history books and museums, but there have also been a few instances when it was used by extremist groups to promote white nationalism. So fast forward to now, the Wall Street Journal reports that Nike got a warning from one of its most high-profile brand ambassadors, football star and activist Colin Kaepernick, who asked to reconsider the design, saying it was offensive to him and people who support him, and Nike decided to pull the shoe right back before it went on sale. I reached out to Nike. The company says it was worried that it could unintentionally offend and detract from the patriotic holiday.
Still is unusual for a company of this size to make this kind of decision based on the word of one person. Can you talk about how this happened?
Right. So, well, neither Nike nor Kaepernick have commented publicly on the details of this back and forth on the situation, but we know that Nike made a huge bet on Kaepernick, embracing him alongside with his strong views and activism on racial injustice. Remember, he was the football player who took a knee during the national anthem before NFL games to protest police brutality against unarmed black men. And Nike took a lot of heat, literally people burning Nike sneakers in protest, after Kaepernick was featured in a big ad campaign last year about overcoming adversity.
Believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything.
I spoke with Americus Fried II. He's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School. He studies this idea that stuff we buy actually often has a lot to do about how we think about ourselves and our identity. And he says Nike has been very savvy about that. It has bet on Kaepernick because of his activism on racial injustice. Reed actually thinks Nike bet on Kaepernick to be this generation's Muhammad Ali.
Now it's sort of incumbent upon you as Nike to portray a consistency of those values that really drove your decision to back Colin Kaepernick in the first place.
So he's saying Nike now had to make sure it does not come out looking hypocritical, and it rushed to act before the reaction started coming in and the situation got out of its control.
Of course, in a way, that still happened, right? I mean, the response has been controversial.
And quite polarizing, as you can imagine. I haven't seen any shoes being burned quite yet, perhaps because they are pulled from the shelves. But you did get Republican lawmakers like Senator Ted Cruz and others accusing Nike of hating the American flag, of politicizing the revolutionary period overall. Then you've got supporters saying Nike's standing for what's right, that it's important to acknowledge historical injustices. The biggest move came from Arizona Governor Doug Ducey. He tweeted that his state will now withdraw financial incentives offered to Nike for opening a factory in Goodyear, Arizona. He wrote a series of tweets saying that his state would not, quote, suck up to companies that consciously denigrate the nation's history. The plant in Arizona is slated to employ about 500 people. It would only be Nike's third manufacturing facility in the U.S. And Nike's latest statements still suggest that they are committed to this factory. Now, as far as the shoe itself is concerned, the 4th of July design of Air Max 1 has been yanked from the stores. But if you are out there on the internet, being sold for $2,500 a pop.
That's NPR's Alina Selyukh. Thanks for your reporting.
Thank you.
The gay rights movement is changing everything.
In New York City today, the world's largest LGBTQ pride march filled the streets for hours. Organizers said more than 100,000 people marched, with hundreds of thousands more lining the streets to watch. The parade passed the Stonewall Inn, marking the 50-year anniversary of the police raid there that started the modern-day gay rights movement. But for many, the day was also about maintaining the integrity of the movement and preserving its grassroots origins. NewsHour Weekend correspondent Yvette Feliciano sat down earlier with Kenyon Farrow, senior editor of TheBody.com, to discuss what some LGBTQ critics say has become the corporatization of pride.
So today is the Pride Parade here in New York City, and all month there have been LGBTQ celebrations across the U.S. When did we start seeing this shift in attention that companies are giving to Pride events?
I think we start to really see a shift in kind of corporate interest probably in the early 90s. And there's been a lot of debate over the last, you know, roughly 20 years or 30 years, actually. Just what is it that we're losing in the process of, you know, the parade becoming, you know, a predominant amount of, you know, sort of floats that are about, you know, companies and corporations as opposed to community groups or political protests, et cetera.
Which there are lots of people in the LGBTQ community who aren't going to mainstream Pride events. Who are groups like the Reclaim Pride Coalition and other people who are boycotting these events?
Sure. So this year you have an interesting dynamic. So you have, I think partly as a result of the 50th anniversary of Stonewall, a collection of organizations and queer activists in New York City who said, we don't actually want to participate in the more corporate, you know, Pride parade as it currently exists. So they decided to have a commemorative march called the Queer Liberation March that would march the original route of the first gay pride parade in New York City. The goal is really to kind of rededicate ourselves to kind of LGBT life as a political movement as opposed to a kind of depoliticized, just sort of, you know, party moment and a moment to just, you know, allow for kind of corporations to market to us ad nauseam.
Isn't it a sign of progress and acceptance of LGBTQ culture if these companies are giving them the same attention as they do other demographics?
Just because a corporation slaps a rainbow flag on their website or creates ads or puts a float, you know, in the parade, they may also be involved in a range of other kind of activities. One being clear, you know, what are their sort of, you know, hiring policies? How sort of queer or transgender friendly are their corporations in terms of just like the workplace environment? In addition to, as, you know, LGBT people, we're not just concerned with gay friendly, right? Some of us are also concerned with minimum wage and wage conditions. A lot of LGBT people are poor. What we've seen in terms of the kind of marketing to an LGBT constituency shows a certain progress in the sense that it demonstrates that we are seen as a group to be marketed to, but it doesn't necessarily mean a political commitment to the lives of actual LGBT people in this country, especially those folks of color and people who are more vulnerable.
We've seen companies like Pepsi and Nike sort of attaching themselves to other social justice movements. Is this part of a larger pattern?
I absolutely think this is part of a larger pattern. I think that what we're seeing, they just have gotten a lot smarter about it because of, I think, the ability to sort of capture data and really kind of micro-target messages. And also obfuscate, you know, some of the other sort of political concerns that people may have with some of those corporations. Many of us like to think more kind of comprehensively about, you know, what does it mean to be supportive of LGBT lives that goes beyond just saying you're LGBT friendly and kind of figuring out a way to get a product in front of me.
Kenyon Farrow, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And then I got into Memphis. And some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out. Or what would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers.
This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, the story of a forgotten civil rights leader, Goldsboro native Dorothy Cotton. She ran the citizenship education program for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and she used education and song to propel the movement. Dorothy Cotton had a close relationship with Martin Luther King. She was a confidant, paramour, and collaborator in one of the most dangerous and important movements of the 20th century. She died last year. 2 years earlier, she sat down with Jason Miller, a professor of English at North Carolina State University. They bonded over their love of poetry and her role in the civil rights movement. Dorothy Cotton opened up in that conversation with new details about her relationship with Dr. King. Jason Miller captured those stories in a new article published in The Conversation, and he joins me now. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Tell us how Dorothy remembered her relationship with Dr. King when you spoke.
It was quite startling because Dorothy recalled the most intimate moments with Dr. King for the last 5 years of Dr. King's life, from approximately 1963 to 1968. Nobody was closer to him than Dorothy Cotton. And it was remarkable to hear that they had this intellectual bond over poetry, this emotional relationship in which she leaned on him. And it's fascinating because we sometimes say that opposites attract. But somehow these two almost defied physics. They're like the same ends of a magnet, similarly charged, that once connected just could not be pulled apart until that infamous day in Memphis, April 4th, 1968.
How much did we know about their relationship while Dr. King was alive?
Dr. King's Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer, David Garrow, knew about this relationship since 1979. But honoring Dorothy's wishes did not reveal it or talk about it. Dorothy was probably a very private person on this matter, didn't want to implicate the King family, and, just as importantly, didn't want it to ever overshadow, as you so wisely said, her own civil rights work and being defined in just one category. And so a number of insiders have known about this, but even though they've known about it, it's from things like FBI files and secondhand reports, she's never told them herself.
Let's talk more about her involvement in the movement, because that is an important part of this. And as a woman in the SCLC, she rose to heights that very few others had seen.
Yes, the only executive member to sit in all those key meetings from about 1961 to 1968 where decisions were being made. And you can imagine what that atmosphere was like. The minute she walked in, there were people saying, Dorothy, why don't you get us coffee or why don't you take notes? And Jack O'Dell, formerly Hunter Pitt, stood up and said, no, Dorothy's here to offer ideas, to offer strategy. She needs to be involved in these things. And so new territory, to say the least. There had been other people that had offered advice and been a part. But to sit down at those meetings with a group of wild horses, as they were known, was really remarkable to be able to stand up.
And to have that executive position. Talk about what she did with this in the citizenship education program.
So the program itself had three iterations. It started on Johns Island, South Carolina, and it began as a way to kind of invest the local people there with a sense of their citizenship, their ownership, and it began with even literacy tests, which at that particular era involved African Americans having to prove that they could write in cursive to have the chance to vote. It was eventually transferred to Highlander Folk School, this kind of an enigma of a place in the southeastern corner of Tennessee, where they realized it had potential to reach even greater audiences.
Of course, Rosa Parks went to that school, right? So there you go.
Absolutely. And when it ended up there, then Dorothy gets a moment where she comes to be involved with it and working with people like Septima Clark, who initiated the program, and Bernice Robinson, the first teachers of it. And eventually that gets closed down on this technicality. They've been selling beer, right? But really they were after them for being subversive and what they believe were communists. So Andy Young, in his great wisdom, transfers the program to Dorchester, and this Dorchester Center in what is now Midway, Georgia, becomes where Dorothy really thrives. And so every month, 40 to 50 people would come, get training, and then go back to their communities and train others around them, not only to pass these tests, but to realize their own self-worth, to vote, and have a sense of ownership in their country and their rights.
It's dangerous work. She's traveling all around doing exactly what the white supremacists don't want, but that would include the governors of these states and the legislators in those states don't want, and not to mention the state patrols.
Absolutely. And the education was so formative for these people. I mean, you say, okay, 6,000, 8,000 people came through, but then they all worked with others. And one of these people became her star pupil, Fannie Lou Hamer, who went down to Mississippi and made incredible changes. And so these people had this reach of what we would call today just grassroots movement. Love is not a noun. It's a verb. And so somebody's got to do the work. And Dorothy did the work as a teacher and an educator.
She was instrumental in the wade-ins in St. Augustine, Florida, right?
Yeah, and it's amazing because we know the story of Birmingham, right? And we imagine and remember that that's not a person stepping up to the podium and speaking. That's the moment of those May 7th, 1963 photographs of the fire hoses and police dogs shot on children. Well, that moment could only have happened because Dorothy Cotton was sitting in Kelly Ingram Park for weeks working with at first 8 to 10 children, then 20 to 50, and eventually hundreds who said, we want to be involved. And so those children in those photographs were only there because Dorothy was teaching them. And then when the cameras weren't there, the very next year in 1964, Dorothy is down in St. Augustine's, Florida for 45 consecutive days trying to integrate the beaches in that area. And so the wade-in movement, she tells it quite graphically. She had two children in each of her hands walking out of the water thinking they weren't going to get much attention. All of a sudden, she spies the police noticing them. She says, we've got to go back into the water and break these rules. And so in the water, she is struck and hit on the left ear. It affected her hearing for the rest of her life. And then for 45 more continuous days, they successfully integrated those beaches.
One of the keys to her success was the way that she used literature, poetry, and music, right? Talk more about that.
It was such a joy for me to meet with her because it wasn't the same old tired topics. I mean, we started talking poetry. I'm talking Langston Hughes. She's talking Khalil Gibran. She carried a copy of that poet's work in her purse for years, The Prophet. And so I'm talking to her about how Gibran said that poetry is the breath that dries the tears. And so all these particular things, but songs were so important. She recognized that this really motivated people, communicated, and what a gifted singer she was.
And it didn't take much to get her going. Well, let's listen, because I know you taped this conversation. Let's listen.
Do you remember that song, Eyes on the Prize?
Keep your eyes on the prize, hold on. Paul and Silas bound in jail, had no money to go their bail. Keep your eyes on the prize, hold on, hold on, hold on. And the audience goes, hold on, hold on, hold on, keep your eyes on the prize, hold on. And we would just make up verses.
As Dorothy Cotton singing Eyes on the Prize, one of the many protest songs that she helped spread across the South as director of Citizenship Education Program for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Jason Miller is with us in the studio. He is an MLK scholar and a professor of English at North Carolina State University. And actually, tell us how it was or why you had that conversation, because you were looking for something else, right?
So about 7 years ago, I discovered that Langston Hughes on his deathbed, the famous Harlem Renaissance poet who we forget lived until 1967, had actually written his final letter of his life to Dr. King. And we have confirmation of this from Dr. King's assistant, Dora McDonald, but the letter has never been uncovered. So I've traveled to every library, talked to every person possible. And so my second to last hope was maybe as close as Dorothy was to Dr. King and her love of poetry, she knew something of this letter. And so I was going there to find out about the letter. She didn't know anything about it, but boy, did she have a whole lot of other things to say.
Other things to say. So as you say, this is a woman who played an important role in an important movement. She's in a difficult situation because she had an intimate relationship with Dr. King, a married man. She doesn't want to interfere or disturb his reputation. She doesn't want to be remembered only as the other woman. What happened when you started talking about that relationship with him?
So it seemed to me that I sprung memories in her that even she had forgotten she had. And when we started talking about the poetry, when we started talking events, there were things that she hadn't talked about because they weren't these tired topics that had been revisited over and over again. I never asked her about those last days in Memphis or anything else. And all of a sudden, things started coming back to her and recollections. And the most important moment of her meeting Dr. King came in 1960 on June 1st when she recited a poem on a program which Dr. King spoke in Petersburg, Virginia. And I just tried to kind of bring that moment back up for her. And she remembered it better than I could ever have imagined.
They also then shared a kind of getaway apartment in Atlanta, right? That was a place for him to get away, and she talked a little bit about that. In fact, I want you to talk more, but here's a clip of her talking about that apartment that they shared and the way Dr. King appeared to view that.
It was like he was hiding from everybody and everything except me. And now these are manifestations of his being really tired too, but also it was like a school. He was like a schoolboy giggling. He's giggling because he, Dorothy, They don't know where I am.
Right.
Dorothy Cotton telling Jason Miller about her relationship with Martin Luther King Jr. Jason's a professor of English at North Carolina State. That must have been a remarkable moment to hear this deep insight, intimate insight into Martin Luther King.
It was, because as a researcher from the outside, you think you just want the information, but these are people you've invested so much time and energy in, and for them to share these moments, they're absolutely precious. We think of Dr. King needing strategical support. We think of the people on the ground, but we forget the emotional needs every person like this would have. Who do I talk to at the end of the day? Where can I get away from everybody needing something from me? That one person consistently was Dorothy Cotton. And for her to be there and have this rocking chair, this yellow rocking chair available where he could just come and escape and talk poetry, talk ideas, not even talk about anything having to do with civil rights movement, had to be such a comfort to him. And for her to share those things and be available for him on that kind of intellectual level. Here's a woman with a master's degree from Boston University. This was something that was just an uncommon thread between them.
Talk about her regrets over her last days, because she was in Memphis but left the day before he was assassinated. Tell us what she told you about that.
It was really one of the most heartbreaking stories I've ever heard. For 5 years, nobody had been closer to Dr. King than Dorothy. And on the final night of his life, April 3rd, 1968, Dorothy is expecting him to come back from that famous mountaintop speech in Memphis. She is already thinking of his immediate needs. Here's a person that didn't eat before he went because he wasn't planning on speaking. And when he comes back, he's going to be hungry and need something. So in those days, she told me, you wouldn't just go out and buy food. You'd have people in the area that would make food out of their house. And so she cured a woman who had a chicken, and she knew that this was Dr. King's favorite meal, so she had this ready for him about 11 p.m. She's waiting for him to return, expecting him to come in her room that was right next door at the Lorraine Motel. And an hour goes by and he's not there. Another hour goes by. It's a rainy night. And finally, after waiting, she peeks in on his door at about 3 a.m. and Dr. King isn't there. Obviously, bells went off in her own head about where he probably was. And so here she had waited this entire night to be of this kind of wonderful service to him, and Dr. King left her. So the next morning, they had what is probably the only true fight of their life. Dorothy packs her bags and says, I'm leaving early, and she gets on a 1 p.m. flight back to Atlanta. When she gets back, she's exhausted. She hasn't slept. This person she's loved has just had a fight with her. She falls asleep. And within hours, a next-door neighbor named Rita Samuels wakes her up and says, Dr. King has been shot. So those were the terms that Dorothy and Martin Luther King left their relationship on. She told me it took over 2 to 3 years for her to get over that. And to add absolute insult to injury, Dorothy gets all dressed up, prepared to go to the memorial service in Atlanta for Dr. King. She's barred at the door and turned away and refused entrance. She went home and watched Dr. King's funeral on a television in her apartment.
Why was she refused entrance?
There was probably some suspicions about how close she was to Dr. King, and there was probably some jealousies about that, and some lower-level people who I know, but there's no need to name, saw it as a way to kind of get even with her for those access she had to King.
As we said, she's originally from Goldsboro, but did not really return to North Carolina.
She didn't. She attended Shaw University and left there in 1952 for Petersburg, and she really kind of felt like a citizen of the world from a very early age. Even sitting at Dillard High School in Rosa Gray's English classes, she talked about, it just didn't seem like I was from anywhere around here. So she went to Shaw University, and we just can't underestimate the poverty and what it took for that. She didn't even have enough money to go to her prom to pay for a dress, and so her father would not let her go. She showed up at the steps of Shaw University at the hall there, literally all her belongings in a cardboard box, not even enough money to buy a suitcase. She would exchange dresses with other women on the floor, so it seemed like they had more possessions than they did, and worked 3 jobs just to put herself through college, and transfers then to Virginia State College and graduates there with an English degree prepared to teach students.
Right, and she was working as a housekeeper. That's what got her to Petersburg, right?
It is. She must have excelled at everything she did. Robert Daniel immediately identified her and said, I'm taking this new your position. Come with me. And so she did as a way to kind of appease him and also get out of that.
What do you think about this? I've heard concerns among people who are worried that what this does about, you know, these revelations about Dr. King and even very disturbing revelations that he may have been present at a sexual assault and not tried to stop it. In fact, you know, how he was responding to that. Very disturbing. But what do you think about the importance of making sure that we know all of this about our leaders and the people who led these very important movements?
These are now historical figures of world importance. At one time, a person like Dr. King would have just had kind of a resonance in America. Now he's absolutely a world figure. And it becomes a point where every single aspect of their life, both the day king and the night king, need to be known and need to be revealed. You know, truth has at least three definitions. Sometimes we talk about it in terms of things that are correct, whether this actually happened on this date or this time. We think of it as interpretation from someone's perspective. But the deepest definition of truth has always been an uncovering. Truth is a secret that gets repeated. It has that kind of accuracy to it. And when the motives are there, for the historical record to be right, to know what actually happened, to get the facts straight, that's a kind of motivation that I think everyone would embrace, even when some of it comes at the most dastardly behavior of the FBI, who was really out to get King and so many other people.
I want to be a cop. Yeah. I want to be a cop.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm WNYC reporter Cindy Rodriguez, filling in for Brian today. Last week, a report came out that showed New Yorkers have made nearly 2,500 complaints of biased policing to the New York City Police Department. And of the 1,918 complaints that were closed, not one was substantiated. The finding was alarming to civil liberties groups who've sued the NYPD for the illegal stops of hundreds of thousands of Black and Latino men. But what does the NYPD consider biased policing to be, and what's necessary to prove it? We're about to take a deeper dive into the 57-page report with the city's Department of Investigation Commissioner Margaret Garnett. Her staff examined the biased policing investigations done by the NYPD's Internal Affairs Bureau. Commissioner Garnett is a former federal prosecutor, a former Deputy Attorney General for Criminal Justice within the state AG's office, and she recently took over at DOI in December of 2018. Commissioner, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Cindy.
So let's start off with the threshold the NYPD uses. When do they consider policing to be biased?
So the NYPD's definition of biased policing is where a police officer takes some police action, like making an arrest or stopping someone, doing a vehicle stop, some kind of police action, or refrains from taking a police action that would otherwise be appropriate, and that they do that because of or motivated by the person's protected status. And New York City has 9 categories of protected status, which includes race, ethnicity, religion, gender expression, sexual orientation, and so on.
Okay. And so, Commissioner, is a zero substantiation rate a problem? Did your investigators find cases in which biased policing should have been provable?
No. So it's important to understand the parameters of our investigation, which is that in order to look at the broadest swath of cases, our investigators looked at the Internal Affairs Bureau's case closing reports for over 800 allegations of biased policing. The underlying investigative files that would contain all witness statements and so on were not looked at for each of those cases. But I think what the takeaway is that a number that is zero out of almost 2,500 complaints should suggest to us, and I think should suggest to the police department, that a closer look is warranted. It's far out of proportion to the police department's own rate of substantiating other allegations of police misconduct.
And so the NYPD says that this is a national problem, that it's hard to show intent, and that this is why they have this zero substantiation rate. So you're never going to get an officer to admit that he or she stopped somebody because of the color of their skin or because of their country of origin. So how else should investigators be trying to prove intent?
So I think it's correct, and we go to I think, links in the report to note that these cases are very difficult to prove, but they're not impossible. And I think in my own experience as a prosecutor before I was at DOI, many criminal cases, which have a much higher standard for guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, would depend on proof of the defendant's intent or their state of mind. And those cases are difficult, but they're not impossible. And I think that while we have not done a deep dive into each case file, certainly the police department can do that, and the federal monitor is already engaged in an audit of those case files. So the cases are not impossible. And zero out of 2,500, I think, certainly suggests that a deeper that there is a problem and a deeper look is warranted.
And so let's you mentioned the federal monitor. So let's explain to people why there is a federal monitor.
So in 2014, a federal judge in Manhattan found that the police department's what is commonly known as the stop and frisk policy amounted to sort of an unfair targeting of Hispanic and Black men in New York City, and that process had there was a finding that policy had resulted in some 14th Amendment violations, due process and equal protection violations by the police department. As part of that, that was a civil case, and as part of that case, a federal monitor was put in place and sometimes referred to as the Floyd Monitor after the name of that case. And over the years since then, the monitor has worked with the police department to improve, and I think it is important to note the tremendous strides the police department has made in those 5 years in terms of the amount, quality, and extent of the training that they are giving to both recruits and current officers about racial profiling, about bias, both implicit and explicit, as well as a number of other corrective steps that the monitor has been working with the police department on. So that monitor is still in place, and they announced in January of this year that they were going to undertake what they called an adequacy audit of the police department's files of bias policing investigations. So they'll take a sampling of the complete case files and do an assessment to determine whether additional changes need to be made to how those cases are investigated.
Okay, so are you saying that they will do the deeper dive? They will look at the actual evidence and say whether, yes, this should have been substantiated?
Yes, that's my understanding of what they're doing right now.
Okay, and so you mentioned training. You mentioned training as one of the reforms for new recruits. So your report points out, for instance, that the police officers that get accused the most are the ones that have been police officers for under 5 years. So that means that they're fairly new coming out of the academy.
Yes, yeah. And I think that what is baked into that number is two realities about policing. One is that, as in any profession, more experience usually produces better quality and more maturity and more nuanced decision-making, but also I think reflects the reality that police officers, the newest police officers, are those most likely to have the kind of direct citizen encounters on the street that produce the majority of bias policing complaints. So vehicle sure. stops, stop and question encounters, responding to 911 calls or 311 calls, those types of daily citizen interactions, a much higher percentage of newer officers are engaged in that activity.
Right. So it's just it's exposure to some degree.
Yes, to some degree.
And so what I wanted to get at, though, is that so these are officers that are fairly fresh out of the academy where they've had this new training. And your staff actually sat in on some of the training.
That's right. Our investigators attended four different sessions with four different instructors at the police academy of the academy-based instruction.
Okay. And they called out a couple of things that were sort of troubling for them. Do you want to describe
Well, there were some instances where it appeared to our investigators that some of the instructors, but by no means in all four of the sessions, but that some of the instructors were perhaps unintentionally reinforcing some stereotypes of racial groups through the examples that they used. You know, again, I think the police department is refining this training in consultation with the monitor. They've been very open to feedback, and part of our job is to keep pushing them to do more and continue on that path.
Right. So I just want to describe what was in the report. So during one course, a recruit asked whether it was okay to call for backup before approaching a group of black people to give one of them a ticket. And it was because in the past, he said his experiences with the black community were hostile. And the instructor's response was along the lines of, I hate to say it, but biases can sometimes help keep us safe. And then a supervising sergeant intervened and challenged the group to question their own biases. Do you think that these trainings would be better done by someone outside the police department that's an expert on implicit bias per se?
So I know that the in-service, what the police department calls in-service training, which is the ongoing training of officers who are in the field, that the implicit bias training for current police officers is being done to some degree by outside contractors. So I think that the police department uses a combination of police officers and outside professionals in the academy. I think there's a lot of value to bringing in that expertise from outside the academy. I think we'd encourage the police department to reflect on that for the academy training, as well as what they've already done for the in-service training for active police officers.
So you also, the report also brings up several examples of complaints that people have filed. In a few of them, the officers are using racial slurs. Let's talk about racial slurs a little bit. Is a racial slur alone enough to prove biased policing?
So under the NYPD's category, no. The NYPD treats something as their term, biased policing, only if some policing act is undertaken or there's some kind of failure to act to take some police action that you otherwise should have taken. So within that definition, the police department does not consider offensive language, even if it's racially or gender or other based in a protected category. They don't consider it biased policing. Those interactions are classified as offensive language, and they're investigated only as offensive language with an arguably a lower standard of proof, which is all that's required, is that there be a finding that the statement was made. And if the statement was made, you can be disciplined regardless of your intent.
Right. Okay. So those are investigated by the CCRB.
Yes, they can be. They are predominantly investigated by the CCRB. That's correct.
Okay. And the police department wanted to point out that there were actually 49 complaints, I guess, that got investigated by the CCRB.
So there are many more complaints than 49, but our understanding is that 49 complaints were substantiated by the CCRB and referred to the police department for discipline.
Okay. So, and one of the recommendations that the report makes is that the Civilian Complaint Review Board, the CCRB, this is the outside agency that investigates police misconduct, take on more of these investigations.
Yes.
The CCRB says we can't do that unless we get the resources to do that. We need experts to do that. We need statisticians. What do you say to that?
I think that if the CCRB believes they need additional resources to take that on, there are avenues to get those resources. I think, as we point out in our report, the CCRB is an outlier among the civilian review agencies in other major metropolitan areas in not handling those kinds of complaints. It wouldn't be a complete occupation of that space if complaints go to the police department originally. The police department could still investigate them. But what we are proposing is that CCRB, when they are the original receiver of the complaint, that rather than referring it to NYPD, that they open an investigation themselves.
All right. Commissioner, there's so much more to talk about here. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you so much for having me and for your attention to this issue.
And my issue is more not only with him, but with the fact that the hearing proceeded.
KITV4 Island News at 10 tonight. Already convicted of road rage and assault, He showed up in court with blackface today.
Now, from Honolulu, for all of Hawaii, this is KITV4 Island News.
The crime happened back in 2016. A brutal stabbing, pepper spray, and people left bleeding along the H1 freeway. And Mark Char's wife was with him at the time. He was convicted of attempted murder earlier this year. And in court, it's like everything went sideways today. KITV4's Tom George joins us live in studio tonight. Tom, the only word I can think of, bizarre.
Yeah, very bizarre. Robert Char used his sentencing hearing to go on a rambling, racially charged rant that went on for several minutes, lashing out at the judge, even attacking his own defense lawyer. And that's all after he showed up to court in blackface. From the moment Mark Char was wheeled into court today, what was supposed to be a routine sentencing hearing quickly went off the rails.
The reason why I'm like this is because I prepared myself to play my part in your kangaroo court, treating me like a black man, so today I'm going to be a black man.
Char was convicted of stabbing three people in a violent road rage attack that nearly killed one of them on the H1 in 2016, but at sentencing, blaming the victims of the attack, saying he acted in self-defense, and trying to explain his reason for wearing blackface.
This kangaroo court is giving me a life sentence for me trying to protect and defend myself against the attack from three guys. In essence, treating me like a black man.
UH law professor Kenneth Lawson says the comparison was an insult to real victims of racial injustice.
The way it came across to me was, look, you're supposed to treat black folks like this, not me.
Char also attacked his own defense lawyer, even threatening him and insulting him right in front of the judge.
You're an idiot from that hill.
Judge Todd Eddins noticed the blackface but never stopped the hearing.
This continues a pattern of disruptive behavior designed to undermine the administration of justice.
Lawson says what hurts him the most is that the hearing was even allowed to continue.
To allow that proceeding to happen, as if that man ain't sitting there with black face on, to me, it's reprehensible. I know we don't have a large black population in Hawaii, but I'm telling you, man, I wouldn't do it with any race. I wouldn't let a client come in there and mock any race.
Why don't you give it a death penalty, man?
Instead, that hearing ending with a sentence of life in prison with the possibility of parole and a message for the man behind the mask.
Blaming everybody for your own volitional conduct, for your own actions, Mr. Char. And what you need to do is look in the mirror. And if you look in the mirror, Mr. Char, you're not going to see a black person. You're going to see a menace
to society. I'm going to see a crooked judge.
You're going to see a menace to society.
Now, of course, the big question in all this was, how was he even allowed to go into court with blackface to begin with? Well, I asked the Department of Public Safety that question. They tell me Char apparently got hold of a marker to put the paint on his face. They say Halawa prison staff tried to convince him to wash it off before transporting him to court, but he refused. He's also going to be charged with disobeying their orders. Tom George, KTV4, Island News.
Walking in the dark. For years, it has been difficult for me to write or speak about myself. Other people's stories seemed more interesting until now. Several weeks ago, as I was walking along the main path leading from the chow hall, I noticed that I could no longer see a single face despite the river of men passing by. It was then that I recognized how bad my eyesight had become. I said nothing to no one, not my lawyers, not my wife, Wadia. I didn't tell my supporters, nor even my personal physician, a New York internist, Dr. Joseph Harris. For one thing, what could they do? For another, prisoners are extremely wary of telling other prisoners about their disabilities. One doesn't want to seem weak among such men. Every time I used an eye drop with steroids, my vision turned milky, as if someone pulled a white shade down over both eyes. I realized, to my horror, that I was functionally blind, for I couldn't read a paper or a book, or even faces. When I went to an eye doctor for tests. A guard who accompanied me said, "Damn, Jamal, you're blind as a bat." He said this because the test showed I couldn't see anything, letters or fingers. That milkiness has since dissipated as I've stopped using the drops. Yet my vision has become so poor that I've used voices to recognize people, as a blind man does. My vision remains more than poor. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Mumia Abu-Jamal. If we have any volunteers who would like to narrate live from death row or any of his other works, he's written a lot of books, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. I've been saying that we should read some of Mumia's works on the book club. And I don't think most of his work is already in audiobook format, but I could be incorrect. But if we have any volunteers, untiljustice@gmail.com, much obliged. Mumia Abu-Jamal, another illustration of black male privilege. Hope folks can maybe send some constructive healing energy, hoping for the best in terrible circumstances for Mr. Mumia Abu-Jamal. Again, what the system of white supremacy, the exact plan that it has for black people. We are here, the compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, questions, counter-racist suggestions you would like to offer. The number to dial 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Few things before we get to the callers. Actually, I took quite a few notes. It'll be several things. First and foremost, we are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest. If you think the program is constructive, you can visit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you visit the blog, PayPal is in the top right corner. Much obliged for all the folks who have invested via PayPal. I was encouraged to also obtain Cash App, which I have done. It should be linked in the description. You can go to the address cashapp.com/$thecows. Address again, cashapp.com/$thecows, C-O-W-S. Much obliged to all the investors who have supported, kept us on the air for over a decade. I hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. If you are not into all of the apps and electronic methods, drop an email and I can get you a physical mailing address. In addition to those methods, you can use the Amazon wish list. It's linked on my blog. It's registered under Gus T. Renegade. Much obliged for all the investors who have nabbed items over the past 10 years. Again, I hope the cows has provided accurate, constructive information on what white supremacy racism is, what it means to be classified as white, and things non-white people can and should do to go about the business of permanently solving the problem. With that, going down the list of things to address, it is mighty. Wow. More details to come about the Florida retreat for the end of the year. Details, dates, all of that info to come. Let's see. The audio segment that talked about the 30-year anniversary of Do the Right Thing. I thought Wesley Morris is the black male who was giving some of his thoughts. I thought that was important to note. There was not a video with that segment, but I did look after I was listening to the report. So this is a black male who was talking about Spike Lee's film that was nominated for an Academy Award, did not win. I thought that conversation, and really it reminded me of that movie. Most of the time when I hear dialogue about Do the Right Thing, regardless of whether it's a white person or a non-white person, generally it is not used to reveal truth about white supremacy racism. It'll be similar to what we heard there, and Mr. Morris gets VGQ, but everybody is not racist. I'm just following counter-racist logic. That is not possible. Now, people certainly say things that are not logical all the time. I might, you know, say a few myself, although we are striving not to do that. But that is not possible. You cannot have a system of racism, white supremacy, if everybody is a little racist, which is what Mr. Morris said in critiquing Do the Right Thing. That is not even my assessment of that film. And I don't think Spike Lee, even though I don't like speaking for other victims of racism, I suspect that he would not analyze his work and say, oh yeah, this was to depict everybody as being a little racist. And I would say the same thing, even if he did, that is not possible. You cannot have a system of white supremacy if everybody is a little racist. Continuing, when they did the compare and contrast with Driving Miss Daisy and Do the Right Thing, Driving Miss Daisy is, wow, one of my favorite films. I think I have it on my hard drive right here. I think he said he's seen Do the Right Thing more than a dozen times. I think I've seen Driving Miss Daisy more than two dozen times. Like, wow, that is one of the funniest racist films that you want to watch. Dan Aykroyd, my man Morgan Freeman, victim of racism, white supremacy. Incredible. They won Best Picture of the Year. And I think it's amazing because it was presented that that's the type of film that we, that America, that was another segment right there. The importance, the problem is white people. I hear so many excuses, and I've heard them, observed them over the centuries, getting away from saying white, even the term au fait, pig Latin for white. Lots of reasons to avoid identifying accurately the problem. Individuals classified as white enjoy and appreciate films like Driving Miss Daisy. And why? Ani said, because we all get to hug and reconcile. That's not what they appreciate about that film. That's not the funny. What they appreciate about that film, that's, buddy, let me do my critiquing. As I said, I've seen that one over two dozen times. What they appreciate about that film is that Morgan Freeman is an illiterate black nigger in Georgia. Redundant. Really, triple redundant. Illiterate black nigger. System of racism, white supremacy. And that's literal. This white woman, the main character, Miss Daisy, finds out about 45 minutes into the film that, oh, this nigger can't read. I'll make that my pet project. And he's in the film, he's like in his 50s, 60s, I think, driving her around. You have a totally impotent Dr. Curry man not to drive around a white woman and for her to insult him and talk to him like a child. It was my favorite scene of the movie. They're packing up the car. They're going to drive off to Alabama. And they're leaving early in the morning, like 7 o'clock. She's got up and packed the car up already. And so he gets there and he chides her. Oh, Miss Daisy, what are you doing packing up the car? You're going to break your hip and I'll load the car. You go sit down. And she says, hush up. I wanted to, you know, make sure we leave on time. So her son comes, Dan Aykroyd. Her son arrives and he says, oh, my goodness, I thought you all said you weren't leaving for another hour. What are you doing? And Morgan Freeman, Hoke is his name, he says, she's wound up this morning. She's ready to roll. She beat me getting to the car. And Miss Daisy comes around and she says, be still. And Morgan Freeman like shuffles off to the driver's seat, and he doesn't say another word. Like, I crack up laughing. 24 times I've seen it at least. I crack up laughing every time I see it. Like I said, he's like a 60-year-old in the family. Be still. Like she's talking to an elementary school child or a dog, even a pet. If I remember James Lowen correctly, pet Negro. The way that she speaks to him. And this continues, you know, all throughout the film. That's what they enjoy. It's the plantation fiction that I've talked about. It's that same genre, the same reason that they enjoy films like The Help. That's what they enjoy. Not the little part, although the part at the end where Morgan Freeman is feeding Miss Daisy, I think it's pumpkin pie in a nursing home after she has Alzheimer's or whatever is wrong with her mental faculties. Even that is reinforcing the same concept of white supremacy, ignorant black male, your only use, your only value, serving a white woman. We might as well be back on the formal, you know, plantation. What's the big deal? That's what they enjoy about that film. There is never a hug. And I don't remember that. They made that up, in fact. There's no hug and embrace at the end of the film. Next, Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing was referenced as radical. Any time where white supremacy racism is being discussed, compensatory calling, we're supposed to be mindful of words. I would encourage caution with the word radical. Frequently, victims of white supremacy will be categorized, branded as radical. I don't even know what that means. If we're in a system of white supremacy, and individuals classified as white, suspected racists, didn't like the film or found aspects of it displeasing for whatever racist reasons, that is not justification for branding someone's project, a non-white person's project, as radical. I think that term is regularly used in a vague, pejorative way against non-white people who have whatever logical views that they have in response to white terrorism. Next, the segment about Nike withdrawing the shoes, I thought that was a total white supremacy publicity stunt, as they say. They use the metaphor Colin Kaepernick as the modern day Muhammad Ali. That's a simile specifically, like or as that comparison. I encourage people to watch metaphors all the time, to be very mindful. And I hear that metaphor specifically all the time, comparing Colin Kaepernick to Muhammad Ali. I don't understand the comparison at all. And I frequently thought it was being invoked to support white supremacy racism. In this particular instance, I certainly do. I do not think that Nike is that concerned. Oh, they're going to think we're racist by having the shoe. Oh, so glad we hired Colin Kaepernick. Cowbell. So glad we hired Colin Kaepernick, and he was here to advise us about our multi-billion dollar industry here. Yes. And the thing that really soured me on it, as they shared in the report, that some of these shoes leaked anyway, and they're available online for $2,500. I've seen this sort of strategy from Nike many times, particularly around limited release shoes, where something will happen and it won't be enough of them, or just lots of quirky things where it ends up being that now there are only 100 of these available, and you know, people go crazy and you know, are ready to kill 15 people to get a pair of these shoes and that sort of thing, and they'll spend thousands of dollars to get a pair of the shoes. I've seen that sort of thing happen before, and Nike gets great publicity for the 4th of July. People get to talk about their brand and their brand ambassador, money that they paid to him well spent. They get some publicity. People can be upset either way about it. Great publicity for Nike. That's what I thought of it. Major act of racism, white supremacy. Next, I can pause. They gave the segment about pride activities in New York and the corporate involvement, I can say that that was on display here in Seattle. They had the big pride event last weekend, although it's continuing because Bellevue is a suburb of Seattle. It's really close. It's like a 10-minute drive. You can see Bellevue from Seattle, super close. Their pride festivities, they have a whole pride month, and it's July. So they're having festivities and a march and, you know, everything you can imagine. But Starbucks headquarters is here in Seattle. They had a big rainbow flag on top of the downtown branch. It was visible from miles around because this Starbucks branch has a big tower at the top and a clock and all that. And so, yeah, it's super visible, their support of the LGBT events for the past weeks. Anyway, on Sunday, this past Sunday, they had the conclusion to the big parades and stuff where they have the street blocked off like downtown Seattle and everything. And I was going to rendezvous with victims of racism, so-called friends, and I had to get through downtown. I thought that the parade and march and all that stuff was going to be in Capitol Hill and some of the other areas of the city. I did not think they were marching through downtown on Sunday, and certainly not at the time that I was going. Wow. Before I even got there, I knew the events were still going on, so I was prepared, you know, for what was going to be out in public. I go out, black female that I know well. She says, "Hey, Gus, what's going on?" "Nothing. Going to meet my friend." She says, "Oh, okay. Are you all going to the pride activities downtown?" Now, all I said was no. I didn't add anything else, no qualifiers. I didn't curse, jump up and down. Apparently, the way that I said no sounded closer to hell no or something. I don't know. Maybe more aggressive. Anyway, she responds and she says, "Whoa, why'd you say it like that?" I said, "Oh, about to get a try." I said, "Just, you know, I'm not going down there. I have no intention of hanging out there. No problem. Anybody is going, great, have fun, do it up. But no, I'm not going to participate in any of that." She said, "Oh, okay, okay. I might. I was thinking about going and hanging out." I said, "Great, have fun, do it up, do it up, be safe." So I think, ooh, I have to be more careful with my responses, make sure I don't get in trouble. I get downtown and they have blocked off like the very middle of downtown Seattle. This is like fourth. This is for if you don't know anything about Seattle, when they show pictures, they'll show people throwing fish at the market. That's Pike Place Market. So the street that they bought, all of that is on First, like Pike and First. That's like the middle of downtown, all the markets and everything. The street that they blocked off is four blocks west of that, just four blocks away. So this is right in the heart of downtown Seattle that they blocked off. I'm walking. They have fire trucks going by with the flag. It is, man, contempt for gender, as Mr. Fuller said, on total display. I was in awe of the money being spent. I am sure that they spent millions and millions of dollars for all of those activities over the past weekend. Just the enforcement officials alone that they had, and they were in the parade. I said they had the Seattle Fire Department had their truck going by with the rainbows everywhere, and the police department. It was the amount of money that white people can come up with for all kinds of projects, but we cannot find the money to invest to solve black people's problems and racism, white supremacy. Continuing, let's see. The segment, Jason Miller, he wrote the report. He's a professor at NC State. He wrote the report about Dorothy Cotton and her counter-racist efforts as a black female victim of white supremacy who is deceased. I am once again in the position, wow, when victims of white supremacy are being interviewed and having suspected racists come to get all of their information about their life and their experiences. And then this white person, as he said, he was talking about another white man, David Garrow, who is the expert on Dr. King, where you have that sort of thing happen over and over and over, where it's a white woman who is supposedly the expert on Rosa Parks and a white man who will be the expert on Minister Malcolm X. And they'll just, we were talking about it with the Charleston Nine 2015. almost 4 years ago to the date, where some of the victims, the survivors, were being interviewed by white people. And I just think that is, I often think that that is a form of necrophilia and just further feasting on victims of racism and tell me all of your sorrows. But I do think that that is an important component of white supremacy, where whites are able to extract this information, use it as they want. They're not ignorant about racism. You can't sit around. You see this for generations, where they had teams of whites go out and interview some of the last black people that were called slaves formally, going around and interviewing them in the 1930s to gather information. White people do this sort of thing. They are not ignorant, poorly informed about racism, white supremacy. That's not the problem at all. But in listening to that report, I especially felt the incorrectness of this, the white supremacy racism, when they played the recording of Mrs. Cotton singing Eyes on the Prize. There's nothing incorrect about she or any other victim who wants to sing, or any other response to racism, white supremacy. But I certainly see massive incorrectness about anyone classified as white. Like, with all of the problems that black people have, our use of time and energy, a white person's use of time and energy, I'm going to go talk to a black person and have them sing me some old Negro spirituals. It's 2019, really? Repulsive. Continuing. Anytime that I hear these allegations, because it just it has increased. Like, I've heard that the FBI has recordings of Dr. King being engaged in what appears to be homosexual activity. Some of that's in Michael Eric Dyson's book, I May Not Get There With You. I've heard the reports that he was engaged in sexual activity with white women. I heard the report there that he witnessed a sexual assault and didn't do anything about it. That he was ravenously engaged in sexual intercourse outside of his marriage. All of these rumors and innuendo, we talked about this with John Patash, where he said none of this seems to be substantiated by anything other than rumors that other people have said. Dr. King's not here to say anything. And all of this conveniently coincides with the COINTELPRO campaign that was trying to assign these same rumors and allegations to Dr. King while he was here, and that these same rumors would proliferate and even, as I said, increase, and they just keep adding more to it. I do not claim to be an expert on Dr. King, so everything that has been alleged, it could be true. However, we spoke with John Patash right when they released the information about the black identity extremists, and he said, hey, I have suspicions about all of these allegations. All of this is a part of the COINTELPRO campaign. Unless you can present really irrefutable evidence to substantiate everything that's being said, I have extraordinary suspicion about any allegations about his sexual impropriety. Dr. King and anybody else that is a black person, non-white person, who was a target victim of the COINTELPRO campaign. And Dr. King was one of their largest targets. He had the biggest files, one of the largest files, and someone, according to court records, it seems government involvement in his assassination, according to what the court said. So that would be one. And in addition, the Cows, we do have a book club. We read Coretta Scott King's My Life, My Love, My Legacy, her autobiography. She staunchly, in no uncertain terms, refuted all of these allegations. She did not say that her husband confessed to some infidelity. She said that all of this she thought were lies, and that she Dr. King was faithful to her until her death. She wrote eloquently, much more so than the way that I am articulating it now. But that was one of the more important points of the book that we read in the book club 2017, if you want to go back in the archives. But I am tremendously suspicious, and I would encourage other victims of racism to, regardless of what stance you take, if you've seen other information and come to a different conclusion, that is fine. But it should be a pretty substantially high bar of proof. Next. The segment where they were talking about the NYPD, New York Police Department, and how they have not found guilty any of the officers charged with practicing racism, white supremacy, that they've had 2,500 reports and zero of these reports were found to be worthy of a conviction that, oh, yeah, it seems to be some evidence that you did, in fact, practice racism. Zero. All of these reports were unfounded. Not that anyone should be surprised, but that makes it stark. I love it when you get something that is that concrete. You have numbers to support. Irrefutable. Once again, since it was a white woman doing the reporting, I would submit white people are not ignorant about racism, white supremacy. There were several clips that gave evidence to that, but I especially thought that it was important, the segment where they said in the training of these NYPD officers, a white officer asked, is it all right to call backup if I stop a group of black people? I've had hostile experiences with black people in the past. There was not even, according to the report, there was not even a query. When you say a group of black people, is this a group of black people on the way to the gay pride parade? Is this a group of elderly black people on the way to church? Is this a group of black teens on the way to school? Like, all you need, a group of black people, and that's it. Yeah, they're going to the pride parade, but I don't know. You better call SWAT to be sure. I mean, simple questions. I've never had a badge, but I would think there should be some, what is that word? Discretion? Is it that general? Just group of Negroes, call back up. They're dangerous. Oh, yeah. They look like they're carrying Bibles, and I know it looks like they might be headed to church, but I think that's Osama bin Laden. Let's go ahead and call for backup. Get SWAT out immediately. I mean, simple approach? No. Sometimes our bias can save our life. That's the response in training. System of racism, white supremacy, and I want to be specific because he didn't say if you stop a group of black and brown people. He didn't say if you stop a group of Hispanic and black people. He said if you stop a group of black people. I said that with emphasis because in that report, New York Public Radio, they said Hispanic and black people when they were talking about the stop and fondle, stop and frisk, they call it, when they had the review back in 2014, that was a big part of Mayor de Blasio's campaign. This is incorrect. It was mostly black males being stopped. Most of the time when they use that tacky, incorrect phrase, it's black and brown people. Now they've switched it and Hispanic and black people, as though most of the people being harassed and stopped were Hispanic, which is not the case at all. Be accurate about racism, white supremacy. I say strive for accuracy. That's one of the best things that we can do to promote justice, help solve the problem. The last thing I'll say, at least for this moment, the final second to last clip where they had the white male in Hawaii, where he dressed in blackface to go to his sentencing for his quote unquote road rage, white terrorist assault in 2016, where he stabbed these people and pepper sprayed them, left them out in the road bleeding. He said, since, you know, this is your kangaroo court and you're going to, you know, mistreat me, give me this sentence, then I'm going to dress the part. I'm going to dress like a black man. This is how you treat black men. Now, one, the man not, because that would be another one. Number two, you cannot be ignorant about racism, white supremacy, and perform in that manner. And I'm using that word specifically. If he was ignorant about racism, white supremacy, what are you talking about? What do you mean? How are black people treated? What's going on here? All of that suggests, oh, I know very well how the Negroes are treated in this system, especially here in the courtroom. I know exactly how Negroes are treated. White people cannot be ignorant about racism. I was even curious about who he assaulted back in 2016 because I didn't see photographs of the victims. I'm not sure if they were at the sentencing to give a report, if these were non-white people that he attacked and stabbed, or if these were other suspected racists. If anyone finds information on that, I'll try and check myself. I did have other information to share, but I will save. I can share as we proceed. The number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, questions, observations, suggestions, make sure everyone has at least one chance to share. If you need more than 5 minutes after you take your initial turn, just wait till everyone has spoken at least once, and then we should have time for everyone if you have extra comments you would like to offer. I do request for this one broadcast, if we could not use metaphors. Frequently, race soldiers, they like those comparisons that are totally inaccurate, confusing, and support white supremacy. Colin Kaepernick is like the modern-day Muhammad Ali, both victims of racism, white supremacy. But again, those metaphors, they can be very vague. Sometimes they do not offer a precise way to decipher what exactly are you saying? What exactly do you want me to understand about this? Sometimes they can be purposely ambiguous and open to a myriad of interpretations. Sometimes racists like to do that because it promotes confusion. Sometimes what they'll do is take two separate entities and say they are identical. Colin Kaepernick and Muhammad Ali are one and the same. Victims of white supremacy, myself included, we've been exposed to this conduct for a long time. It has had an impact even on the way that we articulate ourselves, express ourselves, and myself included, we are still learning. As such, at times, we don't have all of the logic that we need, and or we have not come to a conclusion, all of which is fine. But sometimes, in place of logic or a conclusion, we will substitute an analogy, metaphor, comparison of some sort, and often it just produces confusion. If we could be exact, precise about what we mean, what we are saying, that would be appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Thank you kindly. *61, if you would like to participate. I guess I'll share one final thing. I taught yoga this morning. Had a black female who I'd been talking to, who said she wanted to practice, but she had not been going to the studio for a while and wanted to practice more. And she said, hey, let's practice yoga in the morning. This morning she was talking about. I said, let's do it. We got up, went to practice. Different black females saw us as we were concluding our practice. And she said, oh my goodness, I feel so relaxed just seeing you all practicing. I only saw the last like 5 minutes. Basically, she saw us lying down because class was over. She said, I would love to practice. Like, I'll pay you. I would love to practice. So apparently we're going to try to practice tomorrow. I was stunned as all of this came about because I was not soliciting or asking people to come practice directly. But when the first black female asked to practice, I said, this is why I wanted to be certified, so that I could practice, teach other black people, victims of racism. I think yoga has been very helpful for me and many other non-white people, helpful for a variety of reasons. So I wanted to be able to share, and so that they would not have to think if they wanted to do yoga, they would only be able to get those services from someone classified as white. I saw value in that as well, but to have that happen spontaneously and have it, in fact, not just tomorrow, perhaps teaching rooftop yoga tomorrow, no less, for Sunday morning. Then on Monday, yoga in the park. It's supposed to be 75 degrees. It has been cold here in Seattle. I don't think it has been above 72 degrees in about a week. I don't think it was above 70 today or yesterday. But Monday, it is supposed to be 75 and sunny. Yoga in the park, Monday afternoon, 1 to 4. If you are in the Seattle area and you want to come practice yoga, it's free. We should have a yoga mat if you don't have one. If you want to come practice yoga, I think it's Paul Burnett Park. Might have messed the name up. I forgot. I've only been there one time, but I think that's the name. But anyway, we'll be there on Monday. If you want to come practice, you can drop me an email and come join us Monday afternoon. Practice for free in the sunshine, trying to encourage lots of black people to come practice. That's what the event is being organized around, encouraging other non-white people to practice yoga. So I've been exclusively inviting black people. I think I did invite one non-black, non-white instructor. But other than that, I've been exclusively inviting Black people to come practice. So if any listeners, if you're in the Seattle area for Monday and or over the next 2 months, because this is an ongoing series, so I'll be teaching several classes between now and August. Drop an email and let me know when you'll be here. I'll see if it's on a date when I am teaching yoga in the park. Black self-respect. Wow, it was amazing. And I can even add an extra, totally separate Black female that I saw yesterday. She has practiced with me before. I've gone to class with her. She actually came when I was going through my teacher training. She came to one of the classes that we had to do for the public just to get practice. And so she's kind of seen my evolution in my practice. She said she is going to Washington, D.C. to get her certification as a yoga instructor. I was flabbergasted. I told her, I'm speechless. I don't know what to say. And she said, I had never even thought about yoga until I met you. Now she's going to D.C. to be an instructor. I am absolutely stunned. Anyway, you can have an extraordinary impact on other people. Just be mindful about how you are impacting them. If it's, you know, constructive information about food, I know Red in Nevada and Emmy, a lot of other folks are doing that. Caller in Florida at the courthouse about what you eat and drinking more water, being healthful, counter racism. You can have an amazing impact. Just be mindful. Make sure that it's having an impact. People not seeing you eat Cheetos. People not seeing you watching nonsense, Empire and the rest of it on television. Constructive impact. Eating healthful things, doing constructive things with your time and energy, not being abusive, hostile towards other Black people, being patient as possible with other Black people. Star 61 for folks who dialed in. If you have comments, questions, lines should be open for the first few folks who dialed in. Proceed.
Hello, may I be heard?
Greetings, Irie.
Hello, how you doing? Hello, everyone on the line. And, well, how are you doing, Gus? How's your weekend?
Right, poorly. The yoga was nice.
Okay. I'm glad to hear, well, not the poor part, but I'm glad to hear that the yoga was nice. I do have a question about yoga, actually. If you have, or if anyone else in here has practiced Kemetic yoga or Egyptian yoga, and what the difference is between it and the mainstay yoga. And then the other question I have for everyone is if they've heard of the BAIO, which is the Black African Infrastructure Organization, and if so, what they think of that organization as well. And I'll mute my line for now. Thank you very much.
BAIO, those are the letters of the organization, BAIO?
Yes, Black African Infrastructure Organization.
Okay. I am not familiar with that organization, so I can't comment on that. If other folks are familiar with them, have any details or thoughts, feel free to share. The first, Kemetic yoga. I have not taken Kemetic yoga, although I have read a little bit about it and other folks have shared information, but I am not around anyone who practices Kemetic yoga, to my knowledge, even other Black people that practice that I'm aware of. I do know people, not that I'm around directly, who have practiced Kemetic yoga, and they've just talked about it. I know some of them have said that some of the postures are similar, if not the same. Sometimes it's different naming used. But again, since I haven't practiced, I'm just going off some of the details from other people that have talked to me about their experience. But if anyone here has practiced Kemetic yoga and you have more direct experience, feel free to share. Other folks, if you have thoughts, questions, suggestions, proceed. And if we have any folks that are in the California area. I asked this on Workplace Racism yesterday. If we have any folks who are knowledgeable about how the enforcement of the Crown Act is supposed to be implemented. This is the legislation that was signed this week, Governor Inslee in California, about how you aren't in the workplace. You're not supposed to be able to, as they say, discriminate against Black people who have natural hair. And I asked, how is this going to be enforced? Like, is this through EEOC? Do they have a special body that's going to do the enforcement? And we didn't get any grand answers when I was talking about it yesterday. But I mean, that was a core of the problem, as I think a lot of folks recognize. So I'm just, if any folks live in California and or you have any knowledge about the enforcement of this new legislation, that would be grand as well. *61 from others if you have comments and or questions for your own thoughts on the audio segments, any of the news things that have happened over the past 7 days. While folks are spectating, getting their thoughts together, two other things, or one thing I'll try and sprinkle in as we go. I'm absolutely, I don't want to bring it up. I'll try and go in reverse order because I'm trying deliberately not to bring up anything related to entertainment. I think I've said for years, Area 8, sexual intercourse and entertainment, try to restrict, because I've just seen where a lot of times that can take up more time and energy than is needed when there are other topics that are equally, if not vastly more important, that don't get the same enthusiasm or time devoted to discussing. So I'll try and save my Area 8 comment until a tad later in the broadcast. Let's see. The segment with Mr. Miller, though, he is in NC State. I'm going to post the article that he wrote. Certainly, if we have anybody who's familiar with, I guess, the new allegations that Dr. King observed a sexual assault and didn't do anything to intervene. If anyone has heard more details about that, please share. I am going to make an effort to see if we can get Mr. Miller as a guest on the program at some point. But I had not even... I feel like I've heard a lot of the general allegations that are made against Dr. King, and we've talked about, you know, a number of them over the years, but that is the first time that I've heard that one, that he witnessed a sexual assault of some sort and did not intervene. I definitely will try and get more details. And as I said, we'll see if we can get Mr. Miller, who I think would be classified as white. We'll try and see if we can get him as a guest on the broadcast. Let's see. Other folks with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed. Then people did dial in with a hand up, but I guess they might be taking some time to get their thoughts together, or maybe you're in a spot where it's noisy. I do appreciate that if you're in a noisy environment, if you could watch the background noise, that is always super appreciated, much obliged. I hope everyone made it through their holiday with as few difficulties as possible. I generally try and give out my... I guess holiday anytime that there's July 4th or any of the other so-called holidays where people might have the get-togethers, barbecues, whatever it is. Hopefully everything was constructive. I know sometimes it can be conflict, unfortunately, in a system of racism, white supremacy, when they have these sort of gatherings and events, just priorities. I would hope if at minimum, if it looks like it's going to be bad, if you can't minimize and get things resolved peacefully, minimize contact. Oh, well, other things to be doing. Got to get tend to the children if you don't have offspring. Oh, got to be at work tomorrow. Only gave us one day off the plantation. So good seeing everybody. And we'll check in soon. That always, I think, is a great strategy as opposed to just allowing conflict to continue. But hopefully no one had to deal with any of that. Hopefully everyone had a grand time. If you were around other folks that you care about, grand time, enjoy some sunshine, maybe even got a little exercise, hopefully drank a lot of water and exercised and enjoyed your days and be prepared, rested, and ready to get back to constructive activity at the beginning of the week. Other folks who dialed in, the folks with hands up, are they still getting your thoughts together? Do you have thoughts, comments to share? It looks like they're still hanging out. Not sure. Folks had too many hot dogs messing around for the weekend. Again, this is not our spectator broadcast to just hang out and hopefully listen to whomever, Gus or whomever, chat for a second. Not being spectators is a major component of racism, white supremacy. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you are ready to speak, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, beautiful people. I guess I'm not really that well versed in cinema as maybe I should be. I'm a little bit ashamed to admit that I've never seen Riding with Miss Daisy. So a lot of jokes and innuendos and things like that, I actually don't get. I get the premise of the movie, but I've actually never watched it. So I will watch it this week so that I actually know what's up. And I've really only seen Do the Right Thing like once or twice. And I felt like that clip was excessively long, but maybe just because I was a little disinterested and I just felt like it was convoluted and confusing. And so while they were just talking, I actually thought he was classified as white. And but it really kind of didn't change how I felt knowing that he was non-white after. I still felt as though it was confusing and unnecessary, but that's just me. One other thing, though, I will appreciate, but this is the theater kid in me. I do notice that about Spike Lee's work. He's very much like incorporates theater, and it's beautiful. He actually keeps the art form of cinema instead of it just being about like CSG or CGS or whatever it is, and a bunch of violence and cussing and sexual things all, you know, and like that's all it is, although some work anyway, not to get lost on that. So I'm actually really sad to hear that Mumuya has lost his eyesight or his functional eyesight, and that got me kind of thinking about, and this is kind of like a circular thing, but thinking about the compensation that Black males receive when they're wrongfully imprisoned. But of course, like when I originally think about it, I'm like, there's no amount of money for your time, your life, all of the experiences that you would have had, all of the lives that you would have touched, all the things you would have done that you didn't get to do. But then I guess this might be the first time that I considered the health risks too. Like there's so many bad things in terms of, I'm not being really articulate right now, but so many negative health outcomes from being incarcerated, like losing your eyesight. What amount of money could ever do anything about that or fix that? And being in a building like that for so long, I don't know all the specifics about like how much time he gets out or whatever, but just being in that environment is going to affect physiology, like even your eyesight. And so I kind of thought about that and it made me really sad. I was sad for the Hep C, and then I was really sad at the end of the clips. I'm still a victim, and I have to agree with you guys. It is very suspicious and downright tacky for any person classified as white, of all the things that they could be talking to us about or anything, have us singing old Negro spirituals. I'm still a victim. It was something comforting about hearing her voice, though. So I was grateful for that clip. Maybe it's just the space I'm in. I'm happy that they say when the student is ready, the teacher appears. So it seems as though you have appeared and your students are appearing as well. So that's awesome to hear that, you know, you're going to be teaching yoga to non-white folks, and it'll spread, I'm sure. I think that might, oh, and then just like something else I thought about, I was at work today, but this is not workplace racism. I just remember when I first began participating in the COWS, I was very adamant about the eye contact and having it with white people. And so this might be workplace, but I think it might also be like the gift of fear too for the book club. And then just overall code, being able to establish and maintain eye contact with white people definitely sets up a boundary. I had such an interesting experience with a woman who's classified as white. Not that she was practicing racism and neither was I, but our animal selves were interacting with each other. We, you know, like you could feel it. And it was really cool because for me, it confirmed that this is a real thing. Maintaining that eye contact is a survival tool, I think. And it's been effective for me. And yeah, I think that's it. So I thank you all for listening.
The Gift of Fear, Gavin DeBecker, Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, the book club context of white supremacy. I certainly don't want to give the impression that Gus T. is recommending that people watch Driving Miss Daisy. I am not. I'm just sharing a little bit of my quirky film humor, things that I find funny, because I think of it as racial humor. I think that Driving Miss Daisy is hilarious. And I mean, they casted Dan Aykroyd. He's one of the main actors in the film. He's known as a comedy actor. It's, you know, I think Dan Morgan Freeman, most of his lines are chuckles. I mean, he does talk in the film, but I mean, it's a lot of, you know, chuckling black guy, illiterate chuckling black guy played by Morgan Freeman. That's a lot of his role. Esther Roll, I forgot she's in the film as well. It's, you know, anyway. I would not encourage, there are much better things to watch, I'm sure. Reading is more important than watching television. And if you are looking to relax and unwind after absolutely destroying the MCAT, I can think of about a billion better things than watching Driving Miss Daisy. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a comment, question to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everybody, everyone. No session today with the DCS program. I think it's due to the July the 4th situations. Had a person who was close to me who's also less confused, who mentioned his despair over the idea on how non-white black people are so interested in, to quote unquote, celebrating the 4th of July. Around me, I believe it was Wednesday. Yes, Thursday, right?
Yes, sir. Thursday.
Thursday. Had I went outside with my phone while I was talking to everyone, you would have thought I was in the middle of a firefight, a battle. the area where I stay at is nothing but non-white people. That was a part of a conversation that we were having with each other. There was an offer that the same person brought to me concerning it was supposed to be a meeting with quote-unquote young people, just exchanging views, and perhaps a lot of it would be along the lines of racism, white supremacy, or some sort of political subject matter. And I was, you know, excited about doing it. The place is a organization that was started by some non-white black females that I've been knowing for about 35 years. The name of the organization is Concerned African Women. The founder, Ms. Kiani Nesbitt, might be a very good interview on your program, Gus. She's had this organization with some other non-white black females now for 30 years. This organization. Anyway, that's what I thought I was going to yesterday. That's why I didn't participate yesterday in the program, because that's where I was at, in this office building, and she's on their organization's on the third floor. And when I first went in, I didn't see any quote unquote young people. I'm assuming, you know, when you say young people, you talk about teenagers or people who look to be around college age, you know, in the late teens, early 20s, that sort of thing. The only thing I saw was people in and around that looked to be around my age and just, you know, a few years younger. It ended up being some sort of meeting on a curriculum that they were putting together, and they wanted myself and a few other peoples to kind of like look over it to see if to start looking over it to see whether or not it would be acceptable to the people who have the money to finance their organization. She started the organization 30 years ago and ended up filling out papers for grants and whatnot and received grants and that sort of thing, and they're under the control of something called Children's Trust. And in turn, I wanted specifics on, well, what does that mean? Who makes up of Children's Trust? And I said, is it white people? And the answer was yes. But regardless, it is something constructive that they are have been attempting to do for the past 30 years. So I'm not going to criticize it to the extent of where non-white people do not have control because of the system of racism and white supremacy. But anyway, other than that, I'm still struggling even with the idea of whether or not I'm going to coach anymore, because it would take up a lot of time. And if I'm going to utilize my time and energy, I wanted it to be something that is going to not be so stressful, that sort of thing. And so I'm still processing that. But anyway, that's all I have to have to report. And thank you for listening.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. We'll see if we can get contact information from Ms. Nesbitt. I think that's great to, number one, BGQ, that, you know, regardless of suspected racist direct or indirect involvement, you know, that, hey, I'm not going to criticize another victim of racism if they're trying to do something that I think might be constructive. I think that's always the best way to go, because it's very easy, super likely that you're going to meet probably a dozen or 20 dozen black people who have a different viewpoint or are doing a program that you probably don't agree with at all, or at least a few points of it you don't agree with. No big deal. VGQ. United Independent, they're doing what they're doing. You're doing what you're doing. If they ask for constructive assistance, you can see if it's something you're willing to give, and that's about it. I do think asking questions, though, in a non-combative manner, which is what I think retired firefighter just shared, asking questions. Who are we talking about? Are these white people? Oh, okay. Good to know. And you wishing well with the project. Great. And recommend, see if we can get you some more exposure. But that is important and common. They would be the people that can offer the most resources to get things done. Individuals classified as white. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, caller from Virginia. How's everyone doing?
Right poorly.
Well, I hope. Right poorly. Understood. I took some notes on the Do the Right Thing clip. Just starting out, I was a little bit put off by her asking the question about how should we celebrate this film, and he chuckled, gave this loud guffaw, and that kind of set the tone for the rest of the interview, in my opinion. At first, I did think he was white, perhaps, but then I said, no, let me check. Let me look him up. And I looked him up, and I saw that he was black. So that also set into a different context for me as I continued to listen to the rest of the presentation and what they were both saying. But it was interesting because she said that she felt the film was about gentrification, which I don't recall it really being about that. I didn't really think of it as being about gentrification back in 1989 when it came out. So as they kind of continued, it occurred to me that maybe she was more so linking what Spike Lee is now saying to what he would have said back then in 89. So I thought that was a little bit interesting that she kind of brought it forward in this way that I don't think was the crux of the film in 1989. She also sounded like she felt she was very clever. She made that comment about the Celtics jersey, and she talked about subtext about clothes. And again, you know, just these little observations that white people make, and I guess even the reporter guy make, that just make the film seem a little bit more playful than I think it was ever intended to be. She even used the word precious. She said that she thought the film was precious. And he said that the film was timeless, and that word concerned me because, of course, if the film is timeless, then that means that we're still in a system of racism, white supremacy, that will never end. So I think that was a poor choice of words on his part. And I also took the note where he said everybody is a little bit racist in the film. I disagree with that. She also sounded very happy to report that there would be a block party celebrating the film, and I wonder if she will attend. But then he made a comment about De Meyer, saying that he didn't understand the conditions that would have led to the De Meyer being the way he was. And his answer to that was, he didn't know. I don't know why De Meyer was this way, drunken and et cetera, the way he's characterized in the film. And I thought that was a little bit strange for him as a black man to say that he doesn't know why De Meyer was that way, as though that was a big question mark for him. So I think he was pretending a little bit to be ignorant about racism, even while saying that everybody in the film was a little bit racist. So those were my comments on that segment. I did not like the segment with revisionist history with the white gentleman talking about this woman that's allegedly, you know, had this affair with Dr. King. The stories that they told, I thought, were presented in a way that, you know, we have no way to corroborate, even to say, oh, she brought him food and she had somebody who was going to make chicken for him. And they got into the first fight of their relationship, you know, the night before he was going to be assassinated. And she had to live with that for the next 2 or 3 years. She was not allowed to go to the funeral. I mean, just these little details that are not specific enough that we can even trace back. They're kind of general, those details that they shared. And I'm sure they did have, you know, some kind of association, but I just think it's in poor taste at this time now in 2019 to bring this up and to talk about it in a way, you know, they both sounded very jovial as they described the relationship that Dr. King had with this woman. Just seemed really disrespectful to me, so I didn't really like that clip. And then the other clip that I thought was disturbing, of course, would be the one with the data and the specifics about the police officers and, you know, the younger police officers being the ones who, you know, harass people generally. And then that whole thing about language not being a harassing episode, you know, so they can use racial slurs. That's not something that is disciplinary. They don't act, you know, in a disciplinary fashion when a police officer uses a racial slur. I thought that was very disturbing because it seems to me that in the system, if they're allowed to use those terms and they're not disciplined for it, then they will exacerbate any kind of situation because they're kind of given the, you know, carte blanche to go ahead and, I don't know if that's a metaphor, I'm sorry if it is, but they're given the leeway to say something to a suspected, you know, person, a suspect, I guess, a Black person typically would be the case. And they'd just be able to call that person a nigger and it's not a problem. Just file a report and let's decide, you know, whether or not you said that, but it's okay if you say that. We're not going to, you know, make that a part of some kind of like, you know, more significant disciplinary action. I thought that was really disturbing, but I'm glad that, you know, I learned that in the report. Other than that, Gus, I've been doing a lot of walking, you know, so I've been doing a lot of exercising. So that's been really good. I've been doing some step challenges and, you know, hiking like 8 miles a day. And that's been really wonderful. So the remnants of the yoga retreat have remained in my life. So that's a good thing. I did get some good fresh air in the past couple of days and walking some trails and stuff. So it's always good to do that and counter racism. Just have the time to be in the nature and to breathe fresh air and, you know, think about things that are more pleasant than these things that we're talking about. But it's all very important. So that's all I'll share, and I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, caller in Virginia. Oh, I'm so proud getting out and getting that exercise. That's so important. That is our form of protest. That is the counter-racism right there, Black self-care. I did think the reporter, the female reporter, when she was talking about do the right thing, I thought she used the term prescient, not precious, when she was talking about the gentrification. And prescient would make sense, right, for the way that she use the term. That's what I thought she said. But you think she said precious?
Yes, that's what I thought, but maybe I misheard her. So I will maybe go back and listen to the archives and try to understand.
Okay. I don't have a transcript either, but that was what I thought the first time that she said it. I thought she said prescient. But yeah, I don't have it written out, so I'll go back and listen again myself. I guess if other folks, if you remember that segment that was talking about do the right thing, I think it was right at the point where they were talking about gentrification, as our caller in Virginia said, the Larry Bird jersey and all that. And I think she said, was it prescient or is this just a persistent problem or something of that nature? If you think she said precious or prescient, if you remember, see what other folks thought she said. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, if we've missed you totally, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. This is Red in Nevada. To answer the caller's first question, or the first caller's question, rather, I have taken a kinetic yoga class, and it seems like it's mainly just how they describe the poses. And then I've also taken a couple and done like a couple videos of, or numerous videos of like the, I guess, traditional yoga where they have like the Sanskrit terms. So I feel like it's just mainly just the terms that are used. And then also like just very few poses that were a little bit different, especially like when I remember when I took one of the classes and it had something to do with putting your hands in like a pyramid and kind of really trying to focus on a pyramid type of power I know if I'm probably describing it wrong, but I remember like that was one of the things that was described, but as like the different other yoga that I've taken, I've never like kind of heard that type of descriptions when it comes to poses. And I also agree with some of the other callers about how this, I don't know if this is, I guess this would be the, I don't know, at least the third instance of someone trying to publicize a hidden relationship, quote unquote, about Dr. King. The only thing is that I feel like this is just a part of the dedication. And also, if I'm not mistaken, someone was also bringing up the fascination that President Barack Obama had with a female. I don't know if she'd be classified as non-white or white, or I don't know if she had like a, when I saw their picture, if I'm not mistaken, she looked white, but I can't remember if she maybe had like a non-white parent. So it definitely seems like this is just some, this is just a part of the pattern of trying to change the notoriety, I guess, of these Black figures. And one other thing, or I guess two other things, rather, when I was at the plantation, just, I think it was actually just this past week, I've been trying to really focus on my productivity. I'm trying to make sure I really am as productive every minute of the day, because I know sometimes it is kind of hard and the work does get monotonous. But as I was thinking about that, and as I was trying to remain productive, these two white men who sit beside me, and apparently they're both veterans, and I don't know if they've been, I can't remember what branch of the army or the military they were in, but I feel like they're probably at least, there's probably been at least a couple of decades since they were in the army or active or military, whatever. And they just, for like about 10 to 15 minutes, were just talking about just the different firearms and just like how AKs were, the ballistic power of the AK, and then how they were coming out with a new rifle that it would have like the same power as an AK bullet, but it wouldn't be as far, like, I don't know, like the I don't know what they call it, all the different terms, but it was just, it was, I don't want to say it was amazing, but it really just reminded me about how unprepared non-white people are. It's even, you know, just being just two white men, and it's not something that, this is, you know, part of, again, a pattern that, you know, white men there have this overwhelming fascination with firearms. And just also how they are, both of those people, they're considered good workers, but how they are consistently non-productive, and they're very talkative. One of them, he actually is, he does that all the time. You know, you really can't, you really have to try to avoid even saying a few, more than a couple of words to him, because he will turn it into a 5-10 minute long conversation. So I noticed that, you know, there's this one white female, this one white woman who's kind of over the group, or like the area that I'm in right now. And she will kind of like say little remarks about, in like enough for non-white people to hear. And, you know, some of the non-white people, they'll kind of laugh, and she'll kind of say little remarks about this man, but very rarely will she ever approach him and say, okay, you need to, you know, be productive again, or you need to, you know, cut out the conversation. And just making sure that I, you know, take note of that, because, you know, it seems like it's almost like she is acting for the non-white people, but she really doesn't care, because if it was really affecting her that much, then she could just simply go to someone in upper management and make sure that he is actually written up or otherwise disciplined for his actions. And he's non-productive every day. The last thing that I'll mention is with the two earthquakes that just happened in California, it really made me think about like emergency preparedness, because I've been on the West Coast, and I've been in Las Vegas before. And when California's had earthquakes, I never felt them, but these last two I did. And like the last one, which was yesterday night, it was even, I felt it even more so. So it was kind of like an aftershock, and just hopefully to remind victims that we definitely need to have, even, I know that it's very hard at times to have any type of plan, especially with racism, white supremacy, and just with funds maybe not being where they need to be, but even having something just very, very minimal. Now, I did also, and then the last thing is just also about the earthquake. I did look up where the focus, because I was watching the news, and they were saying all these different earthquake terms. But basically, the epicenter of the earthquake, it was in Ridgecrest. And I looked up the demographics of Ridgecrest, and it was about 77% white, and then non-white kind of made up the rest, unless they were, as some of the demographics said, Latino or Hispanic, which that's not really defined, and then other races, that was probably the next biggest group. So I just thought that was interesting, that I would maybe consider it maybe a sundown town, or, you know, all white on purpose type of town. And that's where the earthquake hit. And I'll meet my line. Thank you.
Much obliged. Absolutely. That would be interesting to check that town, and even check James Lowen's website to see if that's on the list for a town that could be a possible sundown town. Who would even be thinking that, getting information about the earthquake and saying, oh, wow, the Democrat, this might be a sundown town. Woof, James Lowen, Sundown Towns, The Cows Book Club. That is so, someone wrote in today. Workplace racism is Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We talk about white people being unproductive and talkative on the job all the time. And guns and ammo, no less, because I think that came up recently, too. Repeatedly, white people being on the job and having guns and ammo magazines, and talking about the rifles and all the rest of it, that has come up repeatedly on the program. I think my consistent recommendation has been, I think that's one that can be questioned if you so desire, anyone, that can be addressed as a safety concern. It should be, and we're in Las Vegas. Didn't they just have that shooting? That was a year ago, 2 years, a year and a half, hadn't even been 2 years yet. Killed all those people, dozens of people. Like, my goodness, it's triggering me, literally. Like, I don't know if it's, or it, in the form of a question, is it appropriate to have discussions on guns and ammunition in the workplace? Is that appropriate? Does that help promote an environment of safety for all workers in Las Vegas, where we just had this shooting? Like, that's the way I put it there for context. If you're not in Las Vegas, you can just raise any of the recent shootings, pick an incident. And, you know, we just had the shooting in Florida. We just had the shooting. Is this promoting safety in the workplace? That's the way that I would bring it up. But the talkative whites, we see that all the time. And exactly as you said, the strategies, like avoiding, because they'll just try and waste your time and get you into talking about a whole lot of nonsense that has nothing to do with work. That, again, shows the, in my view, that is the power of what it means to be classified as white, where you don't even have a care about productivity, because this seems to be so widespread. I know I've seen it in my lifetime, all throughout my life. Whites, whether it's coffee breaks, smoke breaks, playing on their phone, playing on the internet, like, you name it. Like, they got all the distractions you want, and then some, just chatting with their neighbor. Sometimes they don't even need the 21st century gadgets. They can waste a good 30 minutes talking about, you know, nonsense and how they're upset about their husband and what they did and children. And woof. Workplace racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, Thursdays. Excuse me, Friday, I'm still on the old time. Fridays, 8 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, we missed you completely. Proceed. While folks are lollygagging. I'll make my point since Sundown Towns was raised. That is so fascinating because a listener emailed me earlier today, just a few hours ago, and she said, can you give me a list of the books that have been covered on the Cows Book Club? And I said, wow, that is substantial. You know, we've had a book club for 7 years. I mean, we've covered a lot of material. That is a gargantuan list. And I said, I wrote it out at one point so that I could make a point. But we have read so much material that it would have to be updated. But so many of the different books that we have read, different importance. Someone was talking about Venus Williams this week, and I mentioned Black and White, The Way I See It, Richard Williams. We read that one in 2014. I mean, it's so much material. The Man Not Dr. Curry, so much material in the book club. Reading is way more important than watching television. Other folks who dialed in that we missed totally, if you have commentary, proceed.
Chops hurt.
Greetings, Thomas in New York.
Greetings, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. Dr. King's Infidelities, in my opinion, is one of those who cares, because I don't care. Doesn't change, you know, the way I look at him. You know, he was one of the most known, written, and spoke about figures, public figures ever to live. So it wouldn't shock me that, you know, he's a man, he's a human, you know, women were throwing themselves at him, I would imagine. So it wouldn't surprise me. So I don't have any, it doesn't change what he did or what he stood for. You know, it's just, to me, just something to put there to have something negative to say about him, you know, when it changes nothing. If it came out tomorrow that, yeah, he did, so what? What would it change? Nothing. He still has the statue, you know, it's nothing going to change. The Police Civilian Complaint Review Board in New York happens to be one floor down from the office that I work in, one floor under me. And from the looks of the people who work there, I could see why nothing gets done. All civilians can do is complain, though. That's the whole thing. Hopefully get some type of monetary award for whatever happens to them. You know, civilians is the second lowest status of a citizen behind a prisoner, you know, in front of a prisoner, rather. So... civilians are guaranteed civilian rights. Constitutional rights do not apply to civilians. You can find the law on this. It's the 1866 Civil Rights Act, which pretty much specifically talks about us and tells you the rights we have. And in that right, also a lot of people talk about the 13th and 14th Amendments. They don't apply to us. This Civil Rights Act has all the verbiage of the 13th to 14th Amendment in it. It's telling you all the rights a civilian has. We don't have the right to vote either. That's a executive order by the president gives black people the rights to vote. I think it's a 50-year executive order, something 25 years. Bush signed it in 2006. That was the last one to sign it. It's an executive order. Constitutionally, citizens get the right to vote. We don't. You have to have a president sign for us to have the right to vote. That's not constitutional rights. Do the right thing, gentrification of Brooklyn, very real. Gentrification is turning into total replacement due to the Trump economic empowerment zones, which governors can allocate 25% of the state, any parts of the state with low-income people, black people, and turn them into empowerment zones, which they did, which is why you're seeing a lot of white people in your neighborhoods, buying up property in your neighborhoods. They can invest their taxes, money they owe in taxes. Instead of paying it, they can put that into these funds. And then if they hold it there for 10 years, they get the tax money plus they get the money they made from the investment all tax-free. And they've allocated $2 trillion in government handouts to pay these people for this tax money that they're going to be putting into our neighborhood. So there is an opportunity for us to get into it and make a monetary gain, but it's pretty much it is what it is. They're moving us out of where we live right now, and it's going to be picked up rapidly. One of my favorite movies was one today, Gus, The Color Purple. And all I want to say about that is Steven Spielberg is a racist, not confused at all. For him to make that movie the way he did, I mean, it's like, wow. You know, total racist, and very, very, very strong understanding of the system of racism, white supremacy. And they even had the Miss Daisy moment in there where the lady was trying to couldn't drive the car. And, you know, the lady who spoke about the Black African Infrastructure Organization, I just looked them up. It brought up questions for me. I wouldn't join any organization that calls themselves Black. You know, look up the definition of that word. And I wouldn't join any information that calls itself African or tries to help Africans. And they also push a lot of that ADOS on there, which is another hashtag Black LGBT-led movement, like Black Lives Matter and Me Too, Bill Cosby. Look how they did him. So I just, you know, a lot of red flags came up when I looked at it. MHDC called me. I don't know if he has any commentary, but MHDC. And Gus, have a good evening.
Bill Cosby, much obliged. Thomas in New York, MHDC, were you going to share or just listening? Maybe he's just listening.
Okay, I'm here. Oh. I'm sorry. Too slow on my buttons on this telephone. Greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Good to hear from you.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Good to hear from you also. And thank you again, Thomas. I wanted to say the recent heat waves that have been around the planet, those in Europe, in Asia, in Alaska, and it should have been in America too. But I'm sure, I'm not there right this moment, but I know they're still spraying those chemtrails very, very, very heavily in America.
And that's the only reason why America didn't get the same.
Your volume dropped substantially.
The same heat.
Oh, okay, there you go.
America didn't get the same heat that... Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, now I'm yelling. But the reason America didn't get the same heat that these other land masses got, Europe, is because of the immense chemtrails. When I read the news articles, it says the reason why Europe had a heat wave was because the Sahara Desert, the heat from the Sahara Desert moved to Europe or something. But the whole world is hot. That's the thing. And it kills white people. Oh, there was this, I know you don't like movies, but the Justice League, that cartoon where all the super duper people go and save the world. There was this guy called Heatwave. He was melting a glacier, and they had to stop him. I just think it's funny because they put it in all their movies. I mean, they're straight up. No, heat will kill us. They even have, even in their different languages, the words that also mean fire and heat they're also negative words, and I can point out some of them. But my point is that white people do understand, and they've understood for several generations that heat will kill them. And white people do intend to eventually do a larger full-scale war against black people. But if and when that happens, they're going to pick certain times of the day to fight. certain times of the year to escalate the wars. They're going to pick the colder times of the year to escalate the wars. They'll be in their houses in the hottest part of the days. They'll want to fight during the early mornings, the nights, and the evenings. They don't want to fight in the afternoons. And if they do fight in the afternoons, which, I mean, of course they will at some point, they're going to be in air-conditioned vehicles. Yes. And then, just in general, we have to end white supremacy immediately, as soon as possible. In America, our numbers are too low. Black Americans, here in Ghana, it's really nice being around a majority black population. White people would not be able to treat us the way they treat us in America. They wouldn't be able to, I don't think, they wouldn't be able to be successful with their genocide if we had the numbers that the African countries have. We need higher numbers. We are vastly outnumbered in America. Or even if we're not vastly outnumbered, we're outnumbered. We need to increase our numbers. We need to have more children and more relationships, more marriages, so that we raise our children in stable environments and they don't die, you know, unnecessarily. So those are the things I wanted to say. Thank you.
Much obliged.
You heard?
Much obliged, Imhan DC, and I guess much obliged, Thomas in New York, for the assist helping connect us. Other male caller? Yes, sir, we can hear you.
Howdy doody, everybody. It's Ken Steele reporting from Los Angeles. How's everybody doing? Or rather, everybody's doing right poorly, I suspect, so I'll get right into my report. As I reported earlier, I am in Los Angeles, and I did experience the recent earthquakes that have been going on. And the first earthquake was pretty surprising, took me by surprise. It happened on, I believe, Thursday morning on the 4th of July. And that was my first earthquake that I've ever experienced. And it was kind of surreal. And the second earthquake that occurred last night was even more powerful than the first. So I suspect, and I've been reading that, that there's going to be more seismic activity. And people are talking about the quote-unquote big one, which is the term that they use for an earthquake that should be very, very episodic, very notable, and very large. This one was apparently, these last two were apparently pretty strong earthquakes, but I was far from the epicenter, so it didn't affect me too profoundly, but very remarkable experiences. If you haven't been in an earthquake, it's very strange, very strange. As for the heat wave, the global heat wave that's been occurring, it did hit the United States. And while it didn't affect the main 48 too profoundly, at least here in Los Angeles, it didn't affect us too much. I did read reports that Anchorage, Alaska hit a record 90 degrees Fahrenheit. So that is Alaska. And apparently it should not be that warm in Alaska. It's summer, and that means that there's some new fake outrage that's been going on with the white supremacists as it relates to non-white black children being afforded time in the summer to spend it freely. There's a new outrage, and it's taking the form of what they're calling the ice cream challenge, whereby it's been reported that a young woman went into a supermarket and took a pint of ice cream and removed the lid, licked the top, and then put it back, placed the lid back on, and then placed it back into the refrigerating unit that it was in. Reports indicate that she is being charged with a slew of crimes for this, and the punishments are up to 20 years. So they're saying that this young black girl will get eligible to be imprisoned for 20 years for pulling this prank. And the prank has since gone viral. There are a number of videos of people doing this with various products, but the one that's gotten the most attention was this black girl. And you can see the reactions that people are having to this. I say this is a racist fake outrage incident because the reactions that I've seen, they have posted pictures of various guards in front of various ice cream freezers. So they will have armed guards saying that we are guarding the ice cream. I believe there was one photo of police officers standing there with guns drawn, daring anybody to lick the ice cream. And, all of the white supremacists are denying that this has anything to do with race. And when they're making the complaints about why this woman should be eligible for 20 years, they're saying that there's a potential for disease. And if you are aware of how, suspected white supremacists interpret a black presence, they kind of say that we are disease. They claim that we are the origins of disease, and that if a Negro saliva should land on you, you are eligible for some sort of deadly infection. People are saying that this could cause deadly infections. And, this is all fake outrage, alarmist, and very racist. So, just be aware that this is something that white supremacists are occupying their time with this summer. Also, there's an interesting report. We were talking about Do the Right Thing and gentrification. There was an interesting report out of San Francisco by The Guardian that I think that you guys should take a look at. And it's called We All Suffer, Why San Francisco Techies Hate the City They Transformed. And this is by Julia Carey Wong. And this was published on the 1st of July. And it's in The Guardian. And I think that it would make for an interesting read and discussion on this program. Basically, it's this suspected white supremacist or Asian or whatever you want to classify her is talking about how all of the tech people in San Francisco basically priced out all of the quote-unquote diversity and created a situation whereby you can be a billionaire and you have to step over starving, diseased
30 seconds.
Negroes that are laying in the street doing drugs. And then finally, one thing that I've noticed that is going on a lot on Facebook is that a lot of black people are sharing old news articles as though they were new news articles. And they're doing this. I'm noticing that a lot of the people posting these articles are not reading the articles. Read what you post. Read what you share and try to share current information. Don't confuse people with old information or information that you haven't reviewed yourself. That's just a suggestion. I'll go ahead and mute my line. Thank you so much.
Much obliged, Mr. Steele. Strive for accuracy. Let's see. I did want to make sure that I'll give the number one more time because we have less than 20 minutes. So if we have folks who've not shared at all and you think you have a comment or question that you would like to offer before we conclude, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number two, the ice cream challenge. I just said individuals classified as white. It is amazing the resources, time, and energy that they can invest in everything but the system of white supremacy. Enforcement officials to defend the ice cream sandwiches? Absolutely. $1 million for extra enforcement officials so that a fire truck with a 50-foot rainbow flag can roll down the middle of downtown Seattle? Absolutely. Can we do anything about the homeless Negroes in Seattle? I don't know. I think we spent the last of the budget on the 50-foot rainbow flag. Number three, I do not think, following counter-racist logic, that the number of non-white people makes a difference with regards to ending the system of white supremacy. I think the individuals on the continent are subject to the same system of white supremacy that the individuals in other parts of the known universe are. And I think if racist white supremacists, if they wanted to eliminate them right now, they could. I think there's some evidence of that, them having chemical and biological warfare programs where they were thinking about, we could just wipe out a couple generations of these black people and we don't have to worry about any more Madibas or anybody else coming along to cause us problems. That was medical apartheid in the book club. We read that. Unless I'm in error, if somebody knows, and it wouldn't even be troops. It would just be drones, and that would be that. I don't know who would step forward and say, oh, no, you're not going to kill the Negroes. I don't know who would be able to step forward if the most powerful racists decide that's what they wanted to do. They have the ability. They could do that right now, unless I'm in error. Other folks who, if we missed anybody who dialed in with a hand up that we missed totally, you should definitely speak up because we are closing in on the end of the broadcast.
May I be heard?
Greetings, caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I wanted to start out with the, I think that was the NYPD, the police department segment, where a lot of the language, I was paying attention to it. I think the lady mentioned, I guess, something about protected groups or any offensive language used against protected groups. She didn't really list. Well, I think she did list what the groups were, but it seemed like most of them were sexual related, like sexual orientation and gender orientation and things like that. And there's really no definitions for those terms. So I was thinking of, like, why didn't she define, like, a lot of those terms that I think were recently added? But when it comes to racism, no one really gave any examples as to what would constitute as an act of racism for what a lot of these officers are doing. So definitely racism was practiced in that segment. And then the one where the white man came into the courtroom wearing blackface, he was saying, hey, since you're going to treat me like a black man, I'll look like one, and you should look in the mirror, and you won't see black, you won't see a black person, you'll see a menace to society. Definitely more racism right there. And I think that was a black male that spoke, where he was saying, like, I can't believe this was allowed in the courtroom. Like, I couldn't see whether or not was it a white judge in that courtroom at the time, so I'm not really sure. And the segment on the Nike segment, where they were talking about the shoes, and I noticed that pattern where someone will say, well, I'm noticing that, hey, you know, I'm not going to support this company because they're not supporting the American history. And they, like the white supremacists, they will speak as though they want history exposed and supported. But when it comes to certain aspects of it, they'll say, quote unquote, move forward or just forget it. But when they're talking about another thing, never forget. So the hypocrisy and the contradictions are always present. And my last one is, I don't know if anyone has looked up the news reports on the census. I think they're supposed to be doing that next year. And there was a news report about, I guess it was a certain, what they call a controversial question about citizenship. So I just wanted to ask if anyone has looked into that, or, you know, you as well, Gus. And that's all I have to share. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, caller in Florida. Yes, can hear you, Mr. Steele.
Yeah, regarding the citizenship question, I believe a federal judge recently blocked Donald Trump's request to have a citizenship question added to the U.S. Census. And I have no idea why it would be a problem to have a citizenship question to the census. However, I also don't see why a citizenship question is necessary for the census. I do recognize that that there might be an element, or there's probably an element of racist antagonism associated with the question. However, I think that it's totally appropriate for a government to keep a tally on how many of the people in a census are amongst the rank of citizen and non-citizen. And I think that there's a bit too much emphasis by white supremacists on this whole immigration fiasco. I think it's a bit of a distraction, a temporary distraction to the ongoing campaign against Black people worldwide and domestically. So I think that while there is this discussion about immigration in the news, I suspect that they are using this as cover for all sorts of domestic programs that are going to be targeted to Black people who are already citizens. So I think that we ought not to pay too much attention to what's happening to Spanish-speaking immigrants that may be classified as white. I think that there should be a dedicated focus on what is happening to Black people. Do not be distracted by any of this.
Appreciate it, Mr. Steele. To our caller in Florida at the courthouse, the judge with the case, the white terrorist in Hawaii, the judge, in the video that I saw looked like he would be classified as white, a white male in that case, who allowed the proceedings to continue even though he was in blackface. I hadn't thought that at first. Like, that wasn't when I was looking at this and first read about this. My initial thought wasn't, why did the judge allow that to, you know, happen? But then, and it did look like it was a black guy, professor, who was speaking in the interview, where he said, I'm upset that they allowed this to happen. I think that's incorrect that the judge even allowed the proceedings to continue. I was reminded of Bobby Seale and some of the members of the Black Panther Party and just other black people, period, who have done substantially less in the courtroom and have been bound, gagged, beaten, like have had all types of terrorist things done to them in the courtroom for something that, in my view, is substantially less. Like, this guy didn't get admonished or, you know, shackled, any of that. They got pictures of Bobby Seale gagged and shackled in the courtroom. Didn't do that to this fella in Hawaii. any other folks, final comment? I was going to make sure I get my comment in before we go out, now that we're at the end. Any other folks have any other comments they want to make sure they share? Comments, questions, observations?
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York.
Yes. I think that it's extremely necessary to have a census where they can ask that question, especially since it's slated to have over, in the next 10 years, over 200 million non-English-speaking people, white and black, from Central, South, and Mexico, America. So it's very important, and I really hope, you know, the white supremacists get on their job and start deporting some of these people. You know, as far as the guy with the black mark on his face, he wasn't white. He was, he looked like an Asian, Hawaiian, you know, not a, you know, what you would call, I guess, you know, a Hawaiian. However, I get the point he was making, and I thought he was making a valid point that, you know, y'all treating me like I'm a nigger, you know what I'm saying? So I'm gonna look like one. You know, but from what I understand, he put permanent marker on his face so that even when they washed it, that's as much as it was much more than it was what you saw. It was way, way, way darker. That was as much as they was able to get off. The judge should have postponed it for sure. I told you before, my wife graduated. She started working at a... She graduated with social work, you know, so she started working at a shelter, which is they own apartments, and they put homeless people. New York is one of the few places in the country where it's against the law to not give homeless people shelter if they seek it. So they have these apartments set up, and these people are trying to get back on their feet, and they have families, so they have children. Single mothers, and she has to inspect these apartments once a week. They can't have a microwave. They can't have a toaster oven, a blender. They only can have enough stuff that would be two bags of clothes. That's all they could have brought in there with them. They can't have a television larger than 19 inches. Any of these infractions, they would have to be reported. And it kind of reminded me of, like, back in the day, welfare, how they would come and do the inspections and, you know, where did you get the money to afford this, you know? Also, she told me that they're paying $3,000 a month. The city or the state is paying $3,000 a month for these apartments, which are terrible, terrible condition, vulture and rat-infested apartments that they have these people living in. And inside of one of the apartments, mostly all black people, is a Mexican, and she said that the Mexican lady, she's been there for 5 years. So I said, 5 years? You know, like, guys, I thought they were supposed to be helping people get out. And she said, yeah, but being that she can't work because she's not a citizen, but so she can't work and she can't get social services for herself, only for her child. And on top of that, they're paying $3,000 a month for her. So you can't get social services, but they'll pay $3,000 a month for you to have rent. You know, like, this is what you call the sanctuary city thing. Like, this is terrible. You know, like, the allocation of funds, you know, in my opinion, shouldn't go that way. Either way, it's a system of white supremacy, so what's to be expected. But I just thought that was very interesting. Last thing I wanted to add, my daughter, she graduated. She, the very next day after her graduation, she had to go away to college for 7 weeks course for all incoming freshmen, which they'll take classes and have to do other things, I guess, to get them adjusted to the campus and college life. Either way, two of her classmates from her school here in Harlem also made it to get involved into that same school, American University. So I'm very proud of her and her friends. However, one of her friends, when the school semester actually starts, they have her roommate slated to be Caitlyn Jenner, a LGBT person who is transgender or transitioning from male to female. And she's freaked out behind this because she's like, yo, I don't want to share my room with a male, even though he's trying to transition into a female. And I just thought that this is crazy that they're allowing this to happen. You know, a male should be with males. But then I thought, you know, shoot, I mean, he'll probably get beat up if he went to a you know, a regular male, you know, dormitory or whatever. So it's just the system we live in. And I just thought that was very interesting. And I'll mute my line. Thank you, Gus.
Gender confusion. Just had that in the middle of downtown last week. Congratulations to your daughter. Great accomplishment, daughter, and your daughter's friends as well. Hopefully they'll be well prepared and can learn lots of constructive information to be of assistance in getting this problem solved immediately. But job well done, you and your wife. Let's see. Ooh. We pretty much did our 3 hours. If you have, one, any issues, workplace racism, this Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, tune in, email, looking forward to it. If you have reports, even things related to the so-called holiday, I know some folks did have the office barbecues. You can email and let us know how you handled all of the tackiness. Anywho, check the Black Talk Radio page, Facebook group for updates for our future broadcasts. At minimum, we will be here Thursday for Gavin DeBecker's The Gift of Fear. We just started. First segment was Thursday, so we'll be picking up Chapter 3 on Thursday. Again, if you will be in the Seattle area anytime Monday and or throughout the summer, drop an email. We'll be teaching yoga in the park. If you want to come and practice some yoga, should be with other Black people. I've only been inviting Black people, and we've been trying to make that a priority, encouraging non-white people to come out and practice yoga for the summer. So come out to the park, practice. It's free. Should have yoga mats. You can drop me an email if you need any details. If you can't make it this Monday, but think other dates this summer might be possible, drop me an email. We will be doing the series through August, I think. That said, much obliged for folks who participated. I hope it was worthy of your time and energy. I will say again, this weekend, especially anytime under the system white supremacy, really, but this weekend in particular, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I think enforcement officials, New York and elsewhere, will be out deep. And they will probably be disproportionately located in areas where Black people reside. I would say this is a great time. Drink more water. Get that 100 ounces of water in a day. No need for any of the poisons, narcotics this weekend. That can frequently lead to unnecessary problems. If you're going to be out driving, you definitely are drinking water. If you got to consume any of those poisons, spirits they call them, get to one location and stay there, and then you can leave the following day when you are sober and hopefully won't have any problems. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger or driver. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm a up. Victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.